There is something leaving your property right now that is worth more than you are being paid to keep it. Not the obvious things, not the equipment, not the tools, not the harvest from the garden you've been building season by season. Something quieter than that. Something that moves in bags and bins and weekly pickup schedules without anyone stopping to ask what it actually is or what it was supposed to become. I'm talking about the coffee grounds from this morning, the vegetable peels from last night's dinner, the cardboard box that arrived 2 days ago and is sitting flat against the garage wall waiting for recycling day, the pile of dry leaves your neighbor raked to the curb last October, and the pile from your own yard that went the same direction the week before. All of it moving off your property, on a schedule that someone else set, toward a destination that serves everyone except the soil, 20 feet from where you're sitting. I spent years doing exactly this, running a garden with one hand and disposing of a soil amendment factory with the other, without ever connecting the two. Buying bags of compost from a store 40 minutes away while filling the recycling bin with the inputs I needed to make it myself. The gap between those two actions seemed, when I finally stood in my driveway and saw it clearly, so obvious that it was almost embarrassing. Almost. What I felt more than embarrassment was the specific frustration of a person who has been working harder than necessary for a long time and has just figured out why. This book is the result of that moment, and every season of learning that followed it. The $0 compost system is not a philosophy. It is not a lifestyle manifesto or a simplified version of something that requires more equipment and expertise to do properly. It is a practical, fully documented, field-tested method for turning the organic waste your household already produces into premium soil amendment, specifically through hot composting and vermiculture, without purchasing inputs, without specialized equipment, and without more time per week than most people spend scrolling through gardening content they never apply. The system has two working parts. Hot composting is your volume processor. It handles large, mixed organic waste quickly, generates the biological heat that kills weed seeds and pathogens, and produces finished compost in 4 to 8 weeks when managed correctly. Vermiculture is your precision instrument, a worm bin that runs quietly on softer kitchen waste and produces worm castings, the most bioavailable soil amendment in the entire system, applied in small, targeted amounts at the moments when plants need it most. Together, these two methods create a closed loop. What leaves the kitchen feeds the pile. What the pile produces feeds the soil. What the soil produces feeds the kitchen. The waste stream becomes the fertility stream, and the fertility stream costs nothing to run. Each chapter of this book covers one letter, one concept, one tool, one critical variable in the sequence that makes the full system understandable. The chapters are designed to be listened to in order but usable individually, so that a listener who comes back to a specific problem, a pile that won't heat, a worm bin that smells wrong, a compost application that didn't perform the way it should have, can find the relevant chapter and get a direct practical answer without rereading the whole book. The narrator you are traveling with is not an expert in the credentialed clinical sense of the word. She is a person who has made the mistakes these chapters describe, paid the costs those mistakes carry, and learned slowly, season by season, what the pile was trying to tell her the entire time. She is practical above everything else. She respects the biology, respects the timeline, and has no patience for advice that sounds good in a catalog but falls apart in an actual garden in an actual season with actual soil. She has been where you are. She has stood at the curb, watching the bags leave. She has bought the orange bag at the garden center and stood in the checkout line feeling responsible. She has had the cold, sour pile in the back corner that she didn't know how to read, the worm bin that she didn't know how to save, the bed that came up wrong in May from compost she was certain she'd built correctly. She figured it out. This book is how. There are 26 chapters ahead. Each one will cost you a small amount of time and return something practical. By the end of Chapter Z, you will have everything you need to close the loop on your own property, to turn what is currently leaving your household as waste into the most productive soil investment you will ever make at a cost that rounds to nothing. The pile is ready when you are. Chapter A. Activators. What actually jumpstarts a pile? The truck is still running in the driveway. $60 of bagged compost, sitting in the bed. 3 garbage bags of kitchen scraps at the curb, right where my husband set them for pickup that morning. I turn off the engine, and I just sit there. 3 seasons. I had been doing this for 3 seasons. The peels from every potato I'd boiled. Every paper coffee filter, grounds and all. The cardboard from every delivery that piled up in the garage. Leaving my property every week while I drove across town to buy its finished equivalent in plastic bags with garden pictures on the front. I wasn't composting wrong. I wasn't composting at all. I was purchasing the output of a process I was already running and discarding the inputs every Tuesday morning without a second thought. My pile was in the back corner, had been for 2 years. I'd add things. It would sit cold, decompose into something that looked more like wet cardboard than soil, and smell faintly off. Not terrible, just wrong. Flat, lifeless, the kind of smell that tells you nothing alive is in a hurry. The woman two properties over had a pile that steamed in the morning. On cold days, I'd see it over the fence, a steady drift of heat rising off a wire circle near her back fence. She'd mentioned once, while pruning a rose, that she added something to it regularly, something from the kitchen, something other than food scraps. She said it casually and moved on before I could ask what she meant. I filed it away as one of those tips that sounds useful and means nothing until you need it. I needed it now. An activator is not a product. That is the first thing to understand, and the thing every commercial label obscures. An activator is a condition, specifically the presence of adequate nitrogen and living biology in a pile that currently lacks one or both. Commercial products work. But here is what the orange bag at the garden center will never tell you. Almost everything a commercial activator does, you can replicate for free with material you already have or can source within a quarter mile of your property. The nitrogen source activators most households produce in volume, fresh grass clippings from early mows when nitrogen content is highest, coffee grounds at roughly 2% nitrogen from your own pot or free in bulk from most coffee shops if you bring a bag and ask fresh vegetable scraps, comfrey leaves if you grow them, and the one that surprises people every time, diluted urine, 3 parts water to 1 part, applied directly to a slow pile, sterile, high in nitrogen, immediately bioavailable to soil organisms. It can trigger visible pile heating within 48 hours. It costs nothing. It will never appear on a shelf. The woman over the fence, she'd said something from the kitchen, something other than food scraps. File that away. The first time I applied a diluted solution to a cold pile, I felt ridiculous. I want to be honest about that. It was a cold spring morning, breath visible, standing alone with a watering can I designated specifically for this purpose from that point forward. I poured it into the center, turned it in, went inside and made coffee, and told myself that if it didn't work, at least no one had seen me do it. 46 hours later, I pushed my hand into the center of that pile and pulled it back fast. Not because I was surprised, though I was, because it was genuinely uncomfortably hot. The kind of heat you feel when you open an oven door. That pile had been sitting cold for 6 weeks. One application of something I had been flushing away daily had done in 2 days what 14 bags of store-bought compost hadn't done in 2 years. I laughed out loud, alone, in my backyard, at a compost pile. Now here's what the failure actually costs, because most people don't do this math, and they should. If you run a pile cold and unactivated for a full growing season, you produce at best a wheelbarrow of mediocre, partially decomposed material. You spend $60 to $80 in bagged amendments to compensate. Do that for 3 seasons, and you've spent $200 replacing something you were already making and discarding simultaneously. But the real cost isn't the money. The real cost is the soil. 3 years of organic matter, the coffee grounds, the vegetable waste, the cardboard went to a landfill instead of into your beds. Your soil spent 3 years depleting instead of building. You cannot buy back a degraded growing season. You can only stop losing them going forward. That's what a cold, unactivated pile costs. Not $12 for a bag of powder. A shrinking garden and 3 years of compounding opportunity loss. The biological source activators are the other side of the equation. Finished compost from a previous batch carries the full succession of organisms a new pile needs. Bacteria, fungi, actinomycetes, in established, active form. A few shovels worked into new material inoculates it the same way a spoonful of active culture inoculates a fresh batch. Garden soil from a bed that has been composted for years carries the same community. The top layer of forest floor, that thin, dark layer just below the leaf litter, is as microbe-dense as anything you'll find. These biological activators don't replace nitrogen. They introduce the workforce. Nitrogen is the food. Biology is the workers. A kitchen full of food in an empty building feeds no one. A building full of hungry workers with nothing to eat produces nothing. You need both. A handful of good garden soil. Hold that image, just dirt in an open hand. By the time this book reaches its final chapter, that image is going to mean something completely different than it does right now. The woman over the fence. I asked her properly at the end of that season. She looked at me for a moment like she was deciding. I collected in a jar, she said. Dilute it and pour it in once a week. I had arrived at the same answer from a different direction. 6 months later, $60 poorer, through trial, failure, and a cold pile that had been trying to tell me for 2 years what it needed. The activator was never in the store. It was never in a bag. It was already here. It always had been. Here's where I want to leave you. If you've been buying amendments while your kitchen waste goes to the curb, is that a knowledge problem or a habit so normalized you never stop to question it? One answer means the fix is a chapter in a book. The other means something harder. Which one is it for you? Chapter B. Browns. The Carbon Foundation. Every pile needs the pile is black and wet and pressed flat like a fist closed too tight. You can smell it from 6 feet away. Not rotting, not composting, something more specific. Ammonia. Sharp. Eye-watering. And if you've been managing this pile for 2 months, adding kitchen scraps every few days, doing everything you were told to do, that smell is a particular kind of defeat. Because it means you've been losing your nitrogen to the atmosphere the entire time. Every bucket of kitchen waste has been bleeding its value into the air as gas rather than converting into soil. 2 months of coffee grounds and vegetable peels and fruit scraps, and the pile has nothing to show for it except a compressed dark mass that isn't composting. It's fermenting. You push a stake into the center. Room temperature. It hasn't heated up once. This is what a carbon-starved pile looks like. And somewhere within a quarter mile of where you are standing right now, there are probably 40 bags of dry leaves sitting at a curb, waiting for a truck to take them away to a facility where they will eventually become commercial mulch and get sold back to you at $12 a bag. You had the fix. You sent it away in paper lawn bags every October. Browns are not optional. They are not a supplement. They are half the foundation the pile runs on. The structural and chemical counterpart to every green material you'll ever add, and their absence is the single most common reason backyard compost fails. One thing I noticed years ago, before I understood why it mattered, the oldest section of my neighbor's woodpile, the logs that had been sitting on the ground for years, half-rotted, covered in white fibrous growth, soft enough to crumble when you pressed them, never smelled like anything except earth, even in midsummer heat, even when it was soaking wet after a week of rain. She'd never composted intentionally in her life, but something about that deteriorating wood was managing its own decomposition so cleanly you could lean over it and smell nothing but forest floor. I didn't know what that meant at the time. I'll come back to it. Carbon to nitrogen ratios are where this gets practical, and the numbers are worth knowing because they change how you build. Dry autumn leaves run between 50 and 80 to 1, almost pure carbon. Plain corrugated cardboard sits between 200 and 400 to 1. Wood chips can run higher depending on species and age. Straw runs 80 to 100 to 1. These are your heavy carbon materials, the ones that counterbalance a pile running heavy with kitchen scraps, and the ones that create the physical air pockets that keep the pile breathing. The working rule, 3 parts brown to 1 part green by volume, not by weight. A 5-gallon bucket of kitchen scraps needs 3 5-gallon buckets of dry leaves or shredded cardboard alongside it. Most people add a small handful of browns to a pile that's mostly greens and wonder why it compresses and smells. Quantity matters as much as intention. Build your brown bank before you build your pile, a separate collection point within arm's reach where dry leaves, cardboard, and wood chips stay available so the material is always there when greens go in. For cardboard, remove tape and any glossy coating, tear into pieces no larger than your open hand. Whole flat sheets mat together, form an impermeable layer, block airflow, and take forever to break down. The same sheet, torn into pieces and mixed into the pile, can disappear in a few weeks. Wood chips from tree services are available free in most areas. Arborists want them gone, and will frequently deliver a full load to a residential property at no charge, if you call and ask. Dry leaves in autumn are a crop. Start treating them that way. The autumn, I stopped sending leaves to the curb, was the autumn I ran out of storage before I ran out of leaves. 3 wire bins full, 2 garbage cans stuffed, a tarp pile against the back fence, and I still had half the yard to finish. I remember thinking I'd overdone it, that there was no way I'd use this much carbon in a year. I used all of it by June. A household that cooks and composts consistently goes through brown material faster than most people expect. Every bucket of kitchen scraps demands 3 buckets of browns. Every addition of fresh grass clippings needs a counterweight. The pile is always hungry for carbon, and autumn is the one season nature delivers it in volume, free in exactly the form you need. The people who run out of browns in March are the people who raked their leaves to the curb in October. It's not a mistake you make more than once. A nitrogen-saturated pile, running without adequate carbon for a full season, doesn't just fail to compost properly. It actively loses the nutrient you need to build soil fertility. Nitrogen volatilization in an unmanaged high nitrogen pile can account for losses of 40 to 60% of available nitrogen, documented in extension research from land-grant institutions studying small farm and backyard composting systems. If your pile carries the nitrogen value of a full balanced fertilizer application and it runs carbon-starved all season, you may be delivering less than half of that nitrogen to your soil by the time the material finishes. That's not a minor inefficiency. That's the difference between a garden-building fertility and a garden-holding flat. You feel it in your harvest, lighter baskets, slower establishment of transplants, more pest pressure on plants that aren't fully nourished. You see it in soil that stays harder, drains less efficiently, holds less moisture season over season. The cost of a carbon-starved pile is paid in harvests, not in bags. And it is entirely preventable with a pile of free dry leaves and 30 seconds of attention every time you add kitchen scraps. That neighbor's woodpile, the half-rotted logs, the white fibrous growth covering them, the smell of nothing but earth, still thinking about it. The smell of a correctly balanced pile, adequate carbon, adequate nitrogen, proper moisture, good aeration, shifts somewhere in the second week. It stops smelling like food waste. It stops smelling like yard debris. It starts smelling like something older and more alive than either of those things. Earthy, slightly sweet, complex, in a way that's hard to describe precisely, but unmistakable once you've encountered it. That smell is your browns and greens working together in proportion. It is the smell of a pile doing exactly what you built it to do. That neighbor's woodpile. The half-rotted logs, the white fibrous threads running through the soft wood, the fact that it never smelled like anything except forest floor, no matter how wet it got. I understand it now. Those logs were pure carbon, slow decomposing, fungal dominant, structurally perfect for managing moisture and microbial balance without any intervention at all. Nature had been running a correctly proportioned, brown-dominated system in her backyard for years, and I'd walked past it every spring without seeing what it was telling me. The cost of ignoring your browns is paid quietly. Not in a single catastrophic season, but in a slow, compounding drain. A nitrogen-starved pile hemorrhages the very fertility you're trying to build. Research on composting nitrogen dynamics shows that poor carbon-to-nitrogen management can result in cumulative nitrogen losses of 14 to 20% or more of the initial total nitrogen content through volatilization alone. Every ammonia-smelling pile is a pile leaking money, leaking growing power, leaking the seasons of soil building you cannot go back and reclaim. The fix is not expensive. It is not technical. It is a pile of dry leaves in a corner of your yard and a habit of reaching for it every single time you open the compost bin. Three parts browns, one part greens, every time, without exception. Here is where I want to leave you. The people who consistently produce the best compost, the ones whose soil gets darker every year, whose transplants establish faster, whose harvest baskets come back heavier, they are almost never the people who bought the best bin or found the best recipe. They are the people who built their brown bank in October and protected it through winter. They are the people who never throw away a cardboard box without tearing it up first. They treated carbon like a crop long before they had a pile worth managing. So here is your question. If you could go back to last October and make one different decision about what left your property, would you? Or do you think your soil is building fast enough without it? Chapter C. Carbon to nitrogen ratio. The rule that runs everything. The harvest basket is lighter than it should be. You filled three beds in March, transplanted in April, watered through a dry May, and now midsummer, what's coming out of the ground doesn't match what you put in. The tomatoes are setting slow. The squash has more leaf than fruit. The greens bolt before they size up. You've done everything correctly, you think. You amended with compost. You watered on schedule. You didn't over-fertilize. And yet the garden is returning 30% less than the same beds produced 2 years ago. The problem is not what happened this spring. The problem is what happened in the pile last fall. Specifically, what didn't happen. There is one number that governs every outcome in a compost pile. Not the moisture level, not the turning schedule, not the size of the bin. Those matter, but they serve the number. The carbon to nitrogen ratio is the single variable that determines whether your pile becomes a fertility engine or a slow, leaking, months-long drain on the organic matter you're trying to build. get it right, and everything else falls into place behind it. Get it wrong, and no amount of turning, watering, or activator will produce finished compost worth putting in a bed. The biology is straightforward once you see it. Decomposing organisms, bacteria, fungi, the entire succession of life that runs a hot pile, use carbon as their energy source and nitrogen to build protein, reproduce, and multiply into the population densities that generate real heat. The optimal ratio for thermophilic composting sits between 25 and 30 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen by dry weight. Too low, a pile heavy with kitchen scraps and fresh grass clippings, and organisms burn through available energy fast. Excess nitrogen has nowhere to go except into the air as ammonia gas, and the pile vents away the very fertility it was supposed to be building. Too high, a pile stacked with cardboard and dry leaves and nothing else, and the organisms have carbon to burn but can't reproduce fast enough to generate heat. The pile sits cold and slowly, over many months, does the minimum. The practical field translation of 25 to 1 is 3 parts brown material to 1 part green, by volume. That is your compass heading. That is the number you're always navigating back toward. Something I noticed during my second season of managing a functioning pile. The center stayed consistently warm for almost 4 weeks without any significant intervention. I'd built it with careful attention to the ratio, 3 buckets of shredded autumn leaves to every bucket of kitchen scraps, layered with a thin dusting of garden soil between each addition. That pile was the first one I'd built that didn't confuse me. Its behavior was readable. It heated on schedule, smelled right from the start, and produced finished material in 6 weeks. The ratio made it predictable in a way that no amount of product or technique had managed before. The smell is your real-time ratio gauge. An ammonia smell, sharp, eye-watering, the kind that makes you step back, means nitrogen is volatilizing because there is no available carbon to bind it. Add browns immediately. Turn the pile to reintroduce oxygen, and the smell will shift within 24 to 48 hours. A flat, inert smell, no ammonia, no earthiness, just nothing, means the pile is carbon-heavy and nitrogen-starved. The organism population is too small and too underfed to generate activity. Add high-nitrogen material, fresh grass clippings, kitchen scraps, coffee grounds, diluted urine. Turn the pile and check again in 2 days. You push your hand into the center of the pile. It should be uncomfortable to hold there, not warm, hot. That is your confirmation the ratio is working. That lighter harvest basket from a carbon-starved pile season. Here's the real accounting on what it costs. Nitrogen lost through volatilization in a poorly balanced pile doesn't just disappear from the compost. It disappears from your soil's nutrient budget entirely. Research on composting nitrogen dynamics indicates that cumulative nitrogen losses through ammonia volatilization and related mechanisms can account for 14 to 20% or more of initial total nitrogen content, even in moderately managed systems, and higher in poorly managed ones. Applied to a backyard operation where that finished compost represents the primary soil amendment for the growing season, a ratio management failure is not a minor inefficiency. It is the difference between soil that builds fertility year over year and soil that flatlines or declines. That harvest basket gets lighter one season at a time. The gardener thinks it's the weather, or the seed stock, or the bugs. It's the pile from 9 months ago. The 3-to-1 rule works because it gives the organism community enough carbon fuel to burn at scale while keeping nitrogen available throughout the decomposition cycle rather than releasing it all at once in the early heat stage and losing the surplus to the atmosphere. The ratio is not a rigid formula. Different materials bring different actual carbon to nitrogen values, but as a working field principle, 3 parts brown to 1 part green will land you in range more reliably than any other single habit you can build. A balanced pile heated to 131 to 149 degrees Fahrenheit smells like this. Close your eyes, you're in a forest after a long, slow rain. The leaf litter is wet. The soil beneath it is dark and crumbly, and releasing something into the air that is simultaneously earthy, faintly sweet, and complex enough that you can't reduce it to a single note. That is what you're aiming for. Not a garbage smell, not an ammonia smell, not nothing. Forest floor after rain. That smell is the ratio working. Near the end of this book, when we reach the chapter on temperature, you'll understand why that heat matters, beyond just confirming the ratio, why it's also the mechanism that makes your compost safe for beds near food crops, and what happens to the pile's biology after that heat phase ends. The ratio is what starts the engine. Temperature is how you know it's running. Here's your question for this chapter. If the ratio is this simple, 3-1, browns to greens, smells like earth when it's right. Why do you think most backyard composters never learn it? Is it that nobody teaches it clearly, or that most people aren't willing to manage the pile with that much intention? Chapter D. Decomposers, the invisible workforce beneath the surface. You pull back the outer layer of the pile, and stop. There are white threads running through the material at the cooler edge, fine, almost silvery, spreading out from a half-decomposed piece of cardboard in a pattern that looks deliberately structured. Not mold. Not something spoiling. Something organized. Something that has clearly been growing here, quietly, while you weren't watching. You reach for the garden fork. You're about to turn them under. Don't. That is the most costly mistake you can make at that moment. Those threads are doing work you cannot replicate with any product on the market. Destroying them sets your pile's decomposition timeline back by weeks. Most people who do it don't find out until much later, when the cardboard and woody stems are still recognizable 3 months after they should have disappeared, and no amount of turning seems to fix it. The white threads are mycelium, fungal networks, and the moment you understand what they are and what they're doing, you'll never reach for the fork in the same automatic way again. Everything that happens in a compost pile, every degree of heat generated, every molecule of organic matter converted, every finished handful of dark, crumbling amendment you eventually pull from the base, is produced by organisms you cannot see with the naked eye. The pile is not a container where decomposition happens to things. It is a managed ecosystem where you are creating conditions for a succession of living communities to do biological work. Understanding who those communities are, what order they appear in, and what each one needs to function is the difference between a pile that produces finished compost in 6 weeks and a pile that produces a wet, uneven, partially decomposed mass in 6 months. The first wave of decomposers are bacteria, specifically the mesophilic bacteria active in the moderate temperature range between 50 and 113 degrees Fahrenheit, which begin working immediately when a pile is built and the organism community starts to feed on available nitrogen and carbon. As the pile heats beyond that threshold, thermophilic bacteria take over. These are the organisms responsible for the aggressive, kill-everything heat that a well-built hot pile generates, 131 to 160 degrees at the core. They're fast, dense in population, and responsible for the majority of structural breakdown in soft organic material, kitchen scraps, fresh plant matter, grass clippings. Thermophilic bacteria process these rapidly. Fungi work on a different schedule. They prefer lower temperatures, work more slowly, and are specifically equipped to break down tough lignin-rich carbon materials, woody stems, cardboard, straw, wood chips that bacteria process poorly or leave largely intact. A pile that reaches high heat and cycles through the thermophilic stage efficiently will sometimes emerge with its soft materials fully broken down and its hard carbon materials still recognizable. That is a fungal deficit. The white threads at the cooler outer edge of the pile, the mycelium you nearly turned under, are doing the lignin work. The bacteria cannot supporting your fungal community means resisting the urge to maximize heat at every stage. Allow the pile to cool partially between turns. Let the outer layers stabilize long enough for mycelium to colonize the surface material. Include woody, high-carbon inputs that fungi prefer. The pile doesn't need to be at peak temperature every hour of every day to produce excellent finished compost. It needs to move through its full succession, and that succession includes a fungal phase that runs cooler and slower than the bacterial phase. Interrupting it with aggressive, frequent turning is one of the most common ways people accidentally suppress their compost biology while thinking they're improving it. Actinomycetes appear later in the cycle, in the cooler, more stable conditions of a maturing pile. They are the organisms responsible for finished compost's most recognizable quality, that deeply earthy, faintly sweet smell that you associate with a healthy forest floor or a bag of premium amendment opened fresh. They break down the toughest remaining compounds. Cellulose, chitin, lignin, that bacteria and fungi have left partially intact. When your pile reaches that smell, when the material starts to look and feel like finished compost rather than decomposing waste, actinomycetes are largely responsible. Then come the invertebrates. As the pile cools and stabilizes in its finishing phase, the larger organisms move in from the surrounding soil. Pill bugs and isopods process partially decomposed material. Ground beetles and their larvae work through tougher organic matter. Centipedes and predatory beetles regulate the community by feeding on smaller organisms. Springtails, mites, and dozens of microscopic invertebrates work through every layer. And eventually, as the pile finishes, Earthworms migrate in from the surrounding soil and begin converting the decomposed material into castings, concentrated, bioavailable, the most nutrient-dense amendment the pile will ever produce. The succession is not random. Each community creates the conditions the next one needs. Thermophilic bacteria generate heat that kills pathogens and weed seeds. When heat cycles end and the pile cools, fungi and actinomycetes colonize what remains. When those finish their work, invertebrates process the stable material. Earthworms complete the cycle. Your job is to support each transition, not interrupt it, to provide oxygen, moisture, and appropriate inputs at each stage so the succession can run to completion rather than stalling halfway through. The most common suppression is compaction. Aerobic bacteria need oxygen. Fungi need oxygen. Actinomycetes need oxygen. When a pile becomes dense and waterlogged, when the air pockets collapse under the weight of too many wet greens and too little structural brown material, the aerobic community suffocates. What takes their place are anaerobic bacteria, slow, inefficient, producers of methane, hydrogen sulfide, the kinds of smells that end relationships with neighbors. The fix is always the same. Turn the pile to reintroduce oxygen, add dry carbon material to rebuild structure, and the aerobic community will reestablish within days. Those white threads at the edge of the pile, you almost turned them under. You understand now why that would have cost you, not in dollars, but in weeks of decomposition timeline and a finished product with woody chunks still present that should have been gone. The mycelium was working. The fungi were doing the lignin breakdown that the bacteria couldn't. Leaving them alone, letting the outer layer stabilize, is one of the most high-leverage decisions you can make at a pile, and it costs exactly nothing. A single gram of healthy garden soil contains between 10 million and 1 billion bacteria, depending on the soil's health and organic matter history. It carries fungal networks that can span several yards under the right conditions. It holds the full succession of organisms a compost pile needs, dormant or active depending on what you offer them. That is what you're adding when you scoop up a shovel of living garden soil and layer it into a new pile. Not dirt, an ecosystem with a memory. It knows what to do. It has been doing it longer than agriculture has existed. Here is your question for this chapter, and it doesn't have a clean answer. If the entire decomposer community, the bacteria, the fungi, the actinomycetes, the invertebrates, already exists in your garden soil and will self-organize given the right conditions, what does that say about the fertilizer industry's insistence that your soil needs to be fed from outside? Is what you're building in a compost pile a supplement to your garden, or is it the garden and everything else was the supplement? Chapter E. Isinia fetida. Getting to know the red wiggler. They're on the floor, dozens of them. Dried into thin, dark threads on the concrete around the bin, and more still moving slowly up the outside walls, red wigglers trying to get out of a container you built specifically to keep them in. The bin smells wrong, not like earth. Like something acidic and close. The way a forgotten container of fruit smells when you finally open it after 2 weeks. You lift the lid, and the surface of the bedding is covered in a writhing, desperate mass of worms clustered at the top, pressing toward whatever air is coming in from the gap at the edge. This is what a worm bin failure looks like from the inside. And if you've never seen it, you may not recognize it until half your population is gone. Most people who lose a worm bin don't lose it because they did anything dramatically wrong. They lose it because they did several small things slightly wrong at the same time. A little too much food, a little too wet, a little too warm, and by the time the worms started voting with their bodies, it had been going wrong for a week or two already. The tell is always there before the exodus. I'll come back to what it looks like. Isinia fetida, the red wiggler, the manure worm, the species that made vermiculture possible as a practical system, is not a garden earthworm. This distinction matters enormously. And getting it wrong is what causes people to either expect too much or ask for the wrong thing at the bait shop. Garden earthworms, the deep burrowing species most people are familiar with, are soil engineers. They process mineral soil, create channels, and move through the earth vertically. They do not thrive in a bin. They do not reproduce quickly in captivity. They are not equipped for the dense, high organic matter, low mineral environment of a worm bin. Isinia fetida lives in the top layers of organic matter, manure piles, leaf litter, compost heaps, the thin band of decomposing material just above mineral soil. It is adapted for exactly the conditions a well-managed worm bin provides: high organic content, moderate moisture, stable temperature between 55 and 77 degrees Fahrenheit, and a consistent, varied food supply. It reproduces rapidly under these conditions. A healthy population can double in 60 to 90 days. It processes organic waste into castings, worm excrement that carry a nutrient profile most soil amendments can't match, available nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and a microbial density that introduces living biology directly to the root zone of whatever you plant near it. They are not fragile, but they are specific about their conditions in ways that make careless management consistently fatal. Here is the technical baseline before anything else. A new bin should be started with moistened bedding, shredded cardboard, aged compost, or coconut coir that holds moisture like a wrung-out sponge without dripping. Temperature should stay between 55 and 77 degrees. Below 40 degrees, worms enter semi-dormancy and stop processing. Above 95, mortality begins rapidly. Food is added in small amounts, no more than the population can consume in 2 to 3 days, and buried under the bedding rather than left on the surface. The bedding-to-food ratio should stay heavily weighted toward bedding for the first month while the population establishes itself. Now, the one thing I noticed in my first worm bin that I filed away and didn't think about until it was too late, there was a faint sweet smell in the bin the week before the exodus. Not unpleasant, almost like overripe fruit. I remember lifting the lid, registering it as not quite right, and deciding it wasn't bad enough to address. I added more food, it was the day I'd planned to feed, and put the lid back down. That smell was fermentation. The bin had tipped slightly anaerobic in the lower layer, and adding more food in that moment was the worst possible intervention. By the end of the week, I had worms on the walls and a bin that smelled like a distillery. The failure mode that kills more bins than any other is overfeeding. The worm population in a new bin, typically starting at 1 pound of worms, roughly 800 to 1,000 individuals, cannot process the same volume of waste a household generates. They need time to reproduce and expand to match your output. New vermicomposters, who try to run the bin like a garbage disposal from day one, end up with food rotting faster than the worms can process it, pH dropping as fermentation acidifies the bin, and a worm population that is working in increasingly hostile conditions. The worms feel it before you see it. They begin clustering near the surface and at the walls, seeking fresher air, lower acidity, more livable conditions, before any visible problem is apparent. That faint sweet smell, that's your tell. Not a disaster yet. Still recoverable. But the bin is asking for a pause and a correction before it tips past the point where your worms make the decision for you. When you open a healthy bin, no drama, just routine feeding, you should smell earth. Slightly sweet earthy, faintly complex, nothing offensive. You should see worms moving away from the light when you disturb the surface, active, reddish-brown, full-bodied. You should see evidence of consumption, food from the previous feeding visibly reduced, with castings, small, dark, irregular granules, accumulating near the surface. Cocoons appear as tiny, lemon-shaped amber capsules about the size of a matchhead. Their presence means the population is reproducing and conditions are acceptable. The cost of a failed worm bin is rarely calculated honestly. Most people think of the worms. A pound of Eisenia fetida runs between $25 and $40, but the real cost is the production timeline. A healthy, established worm bin running at full capacity generates finished castings in roughly 60 to 90 days. If your bin crashes and you restart from scratch, that timeline resets completely. 3 months of castings production, the most bioavailable amendment in your entire system, simply doesn't happen. Applied to the garden, that means 3 months without the transplant establishment boost that worm castings provide, without the microbial injection at the root zone, without the nutrient availability that makes early season growth so visibly different in beds that receive regular casting applications. That's not $40, that's a season. The worm bin failure on the floor that I described at the start of this chapter, the worms on the concrete, the smell, the mass exodus, happened because I missed a signal the bin gave me a full week before the crisis. One faint sweet smell. One small sign that the system was tipping toward trouble. I had the information I needed to prevent it, and I chose to interpret it as unimportant. You will not always catch the signal in time, but you will catch it eventually, and once you know what the bin smells like when it's right versus when it's drifting wrong, you'll never ignore a sweet smell in the lid again. So here's the question this chapter leaves open. A worm bin is one of the most productive fertility tools available to a homesteader, and it costs almost nothing to maintain. If so many people abandon theirs after the first failure, and they do, is that a problem with vermiculture or a problem with how we are taught to approach any system that requires ongoing observation rather than a one-time setup? Chapter F. Finished compost. How to know when it's truly ready. The transplants went in on a Tuesday. By Friday, three of the six were yellowing at the base. By the following Monday, they were wilting in a way that didn't respond to water. The soil was moist, drainage was fine, and yet the leaves were going soft and pale in a pattern that looked like nitrogen deficiency in a bed you just heavily amended. By the end of the second week, two of the six were dead, and the other four were surviving rather than thriving. The compost in those beds wasn't bad. It wasn't contaminated. It wasn't the wrong type. It was unfinished. It looked finished. That's the part that stays with me. Dark in color, low in recognizable structure, not particularly odorous. I had pulled it from a pile that had been running for 8 months and assumed that duration meant completion. It did not. What I put into those beds was still actively decomposing, and when the microbes in it hit the soil, they did what microbes in active decomposition always do. They scavenged available nitrogen from the surrounding environment to fuel their process. They took it from my transplants. The seedlings I was trying to feed were being starved by the amendment I'd added to feed them. Finished compost and mature compost look similar to the untrained eye. The difference between them is not visual. It is biological, chemical, and testable, and knowing the difference protects every transplant, every seedbed, every soil amendment application you will ever make. Here is what finished compost actually is. Organic matter that has completed the active decomposition process, stabilized its biological activity, and converted its nutrients into forms that are available to plants rather than being consumed by an ongoing microbial community. The organisms in finished compost are not in a feeding frenzy. They are in maintenance mode, present, alive, but no longer consuming nitrogen at the rate of active decomposition. This is the compost you want against your plant roots. This is the amendment that builds soil rather than temporarily competing with it. The sensory test is the first and most accessible diagnostic tool. Finished compost smells like forest floor, that clean, earthy, faintly mushroomy smell that carries no trace of what went in. A pile still in active decomposition smells like something identifiable, ammonia if nitrogen heavy, a sweet-sour fermentation note if slightly anaerobic, or a detectable trace of the original materials, food scraps, grass, whatever was added in the last few weeks. That smell is biological activity still running at pace. It means the pile isn't done. Something I filed away during my third year of composting, before I understood what it meant. A pile I'd pulled compost from in late September had small green seedlings appearing across the surface of the bed by early October. Tiny, uniform, dozens of them across 3 square feet. I assumed they were from seed contamination in the soil itself, a weed flush from disturbed ground. I pulled them, planted over them, and moved on. By late the following spring, I had figured out what they were. The pile that had produced that compost had never heated above 110 degrees, not hot enough to kill weed seeds. The compost was biologically stable enough to pass the smell test, but structurally incomplete. I'd been planting in a slow-release weed bank and calling it an amendment. I'll come back to what the temperature record tells you about whether a pile is truly finished. The practical tests for finished compost in order of accessibility. The smell test is first earth, no identifiable inputs, nothing offensive. The texture test is second, dark, uniform, crumbly, no recognizable structure from original materials except possibly some wood chip fragments which take longer to break down. The squeeze test, finished compost, holds a handful pressed tight and releases it into loose crumbles rather than sticking together in a wet mass. The bag test, seal a small sample in a zip-close bag for 3 days. If it smells earthy when you open it, it's stable. If it smells like ammonia, sulfur, or anything sharp and unpleasant, the biological process is still active and the pile needs more time. The most reliable test for large-scale application is germination. Plant a few fast-germinating seeds, radish or cress work well, directly into the compost or into a 50-50 mix of compost and potting soil. If they germinate and grow normally over 7 to 10 days, the compost is finished. If they fail to germinate, germinate poorly, or emerge and then yellow and stall, the compost still contains compounds toxic to seedlings, acids, phenols, or excess ammonia from incomplete decomposition. This test costs almost nothing and will save you from the transplant failure I described in the opening of this chapter. The cost of applying unfinished compost is poorly understood because the damage isn't always dramatic. Sometimes you lose transplants outright, roots burned by excess ammonia and salts, seedlings yellowing from nitrogen starvation as microbes scavenge the bed. More often, the damage is subtle. Plants establish slowly, Growth is underwhelming in the first 4 to 6 weeks. You assume the variety underperformed or the season was difficult, and you never connect it to the amendment you applied in early spring. Unfinished compost applied to an established bed doesn't kill adult plants. It competes with them. It holds their early season growth at a fraction of its potential, while the biological process the pile didn't finish runs to completion in your soil instead of in the pile where it belongs. This is one of the most underreported failures in small-scale growing. Not a dramatic loss, a quiet underperformance that accumulates across seasons while you try to diagnose it as a watering problem, a soil pH problem, a pest problem, anything except the compost you added in April. The weed seedlings in October. The pile that never got hot enough. If your thermophilic pile never reaches 131 to 149 degrees Fahrenheit during its active phase, it has not completed the thermal kill of weed seeds and potential pathogens. The compost may smell right, test stable, and look finished, but it carries a biological legacy of whatever was in the pile that the heat didn't process. You will plant it into beds and find out in October or the following spring what it was still holding. Finished compost is the output the entire $0 system is designed to produce. Everything in this book, the ratio management, the aeration, the activators, the succession of decomposers, is in service of arriving at this one material, dark, stable, earthy, biologically complete. It is worth waiting for. Applying it too early is not a shortcut. It is a way of doing the work twice, once in the pile, and again, slowly, and at the expense of your plants in the bed. Here is your question. If the germination test is this simple and the cost of getting it wrong is this high, stunted transplants, weed seed banks, nitrogen competition in beds you spent months building, why do so many experienced gardeners skip it? Is it impatience, overconfidence, or something about how we're taught to think about compost as a finished product the moment we decide it should be? Chapter G. Greens, your nitrogen engine, and how to feed it. The pile is 3 feet tall and 4 months old, and it has not moved. It sits there, the same approximate height, the same approximate color, the same approximate texture it had when you finished building it in early fall. You've turned it twice. You've watered it when it dried out. You've done, by every account you can find, what you were supposed to do. And in 4 months, it has produced exactly nothing. No heat, no visible collapse, no transformation. It looks less like compost, and less like a pile of dead leaves either. It just looks like a pile. Your nitrogen is gone. That's the entire problem. Whatever green material you added when you built this pile decomposed or volatilized in the first few weeks, and what remains is pure carbon, stable, inert, completely unable to sustain microbial metabolism at any meaningful rate without a nitrogen source. You have built the best structured, best aerated, perfectly proportioned pile of 400-to-1 carbon fuel with no engine to ignite it. Without nitrogen, no engine runs. Greens are the nitrogen side of the carbon-to-nitrogen equation, and everything in the previous chapter on ratio management points back to what happens here. Greens don't just feed the pile, they dictate the pace, the temperature, and the biological density of everything that follows. A pile that never gets hot is almost always a pile that ran out of nitrogen too early, was never given enough to begin with, or was given nitrogen in a form the microbial community couldn't access fast enough to sustain thermophilic activity. Understanding which greens do what and when, and how much, is what separates a pile that heats reliably from a pile that sits and waits. One thing I noticed early in my second season that I didn't have language for at the time, a thick layer of grass clippings I'd added to the pile on a Wednesday, was by Saturday, a black slick mat at the center of the pile, airless, slightly slimy, smelling of something between fermentation and low tide. The pile had heated briefly and then gone wrong. The clippings on top had looked perfectly fine. What was underneath them had gone anaerobic almost immediately. I turned it out, broke it apart, and found that the center smelled nothing like what I expected, not like compost. Like the bottom of a neglected flower vase, I rearranged the material, and the pile recovered, but it lost nearly a week of active decomposition to that mat. I'll come back to why. Fresh grass clippings are the most accessible high-nitrogen green material most homesteaders produce in consistent volume, and they are also one of the most misunderstood. At a carbon-to-nitrogen ratio between 15 and 25 to 1, they are among the highest nitrogen materials available without animal inputs. Added to a carbon-heavy pile, they can trigger visible heating within 24 to 48 hours. Used incorrectly, dumped in thick, uniform layers rather than mixed, they become one of the most effective ways to create an anaerobic pocket in an otherwise healthy pile. The mat I found in the middle of the pile was a textbook grass clipping failure. A thick, dense layer of fresh clippings, high in moisture, compacted under the weight of material above, had sealed off oxygen from everything beneath it. The bacteria in the sealed zone went anaerobic within days. The clippings fermented rather than composted, and the smell and the loss of biological activity spread outward from the mat before I caught it. Grass clippings should never be added in layers deeper than 1 to 2 inches. They should always be mixed with a structural brown material. Wood chips work particularly well because they resist compression and keep the clippings from fusing together. Applied correctly, grass clippings are among the most powerful nitrogen inputs available for free. Applied incorrectly, they are one of the fastest ways to stall an active pile. Coffee grounds run at approximately 20 to 1 carbon to nitrogen, are high in available nitrogen, and have the additional advantage of being free in virtually unlimited quantities from any coffee shop willing to save them. They do not make the pile acidic, despite persistent belief to the contrary. Coffee grounds are pH neutral to very slightly acidic once dried, and in the volume typically available to a home composter, they have negligible effect on pile pH. They can be added in large quantities alongside brown material without concern. Fresh vegetable scraps from the kitchen average around 15 to 1. They introduce nitrogen, moisture, and a range of trace minerals depending on what you're composting. Fruit scraps run similarly, but higher in sugars, which decompose fast and can briefly spike microbial activity. Citrus in moderation is fine. The idea that citrus is toxic to compost is one of the more persistent myths in home composting, unsupported by practical evidence. Worms in a vermicomposting system may avoid fresh citrus peel in large quantities because of the essential oils, but a hot pile processes it without issue. Fresh plant trimmings, the spent vines, overgrown herbs, thinned seedlings, bolted greens are among the most nitrogen-dense green materials a garden produces. They often go to waste because they arrive in small, inconvenient amounts rather than in the bucket-load volumes that kitchen scraps come in. Make a habit of keeping a collection point near the garden specifically for fresh trimmings. A small pile, a bucket, a corner of the bin, anything that intercepts this material before it gets pitched over the fence or left to decompose on the ground where it benefits no one. The high-stakes failure of green mismanagement is not the dramatic pile collapse. It's the slow, season-long drain of a pile that never got to operating temperature because its nitrogen was exhausted too early or distributed too poorly to sustain the biological density needed for thermophilic activity. A pile that peaks at 110 degrees instead of 140 degrees doesn't just compost more slowly, it produces a different quality of output. Weed seeds survive, some pathogens survive, the succession of decomposers runs incompletely. The finished product, applied to beds, carries biological baggage that a pile that hit temperature wouldn't have passed on. That is the real cost of a nitrogen-deficient pile, and it compounds. You apply compost that isn't fully mature. It introduces weed seed banks to the bed. You spend time in June hand-pulling weeds from a bed you spent months building. You trace it to the wrong season, the wrong seed source, the wrong weather. The pile in the back corner, the one that never got hot enough because you didn't add enough greens or didn't mix the clippings properly, never enters the calculation. That black slick mat in the center of the pile, the anaerobic zone created by a thick layer of unmixed grass clippings. The smell of fermentation spreading outward before I caught it. Here's what I understand now that I didn't then. The mat was a self-sealing problem. The clippings created a barrier. The barrier created an anaerobic zone. The anaerobic zone produced compounds that the aerobic organisms in the surrounding material found hostile, and the problem expanded rather than stabilizing. Breaking the mat and introducing oxygen stopped the spread, but the week of lost biological activity couldn't be recovered. A thin layer of clippings, mixed with wood chips, would have given the same nitrogen input without creating the conditions for any of it. Greens are not the simpler half of the carbon to nitrogen equation. Browns are easier to store and slower to cause problems. Greens act fast, in both directions, toward rapid heat when managed well, toward rapid failure when they're not. Understanding the difference between a green that accelerates and a green that mats, smells, or acidifies is what allows you to manage the nitrogen side of the pile with the same precision you'd apply to the carbon side. Here is your question. Every green material in this chapter is available for free, in volume, to most homesteaders, kitchen scraps, grass clippings, coffee grounds, garden trimmings. If the nitrogen engine of a compost system requires no investment whatsoever, why do you think bag fertilizers continue to outsell composting as the primary fertility strategy in backyard growing? Is it a marketing problem? a patient's problem, or something about how we measure results? Chapter H, Hot Composting, the Thermophilic Method. Step by step, you push the thermometer into the center of the pile and watch the dial. It climbs past 60, past 70, it settles at 82 degrees Fahrenheit, and stays there. You built this pile 2 days ago, 3 feet by 3 feet, layered carefully, watered through the ratio as close to 3 to 1 as you could manage. 82 degrees, room temperature plus a few degrees. A body of material sitting in the sun on a warm afternoon would read nearly that on its own. The pile is not composting, it is sitting. Here is what you did wrong, and here is exactly how to fix it. Because a pile that fails to heat inside the first 48 hours is always telling you something specific, and it's always fixable if you know what to listen for. Hot composting is the most efficient biological process available to a homesteader for converting raw organic waste into finished soil amendment. Done correctly, a thermophilic pile reaches between 131 and 160 degrees Fahrenheit within the first 2 to 3 days of construction, sustains that heat through the first week, and cycles through multiple heat and turn sequences to produce finished compost in 4 to 8 weeks. Nothing else in the $0 system comes close to that speed, but the thermophilic process is not forgiving of structural errors. You cannot build a pile incorrectly and expect heat to emerge through patience. The biology either has what it needs on day one, or it doesn't, and no amount of waiting will substitute for what's missing. I want to walk you through the method the way I wish someone had walked me through it. Not as a list of steps, but as a sequence of decisions, each one connected to a specific biological reason that makes it non-negotiable. Something I noticed on the second pile I ever built, that actually heated, the right half of the pile, closest to a wood chip pile I'd stacked against the fence, reached 147 degrees by day 3. The left half peaked at 91 and stalled. The pile was the same material throughout. I'd built it in one session, layered it uniformly, watered it evenly. The asymmetry made no sense to me at the time. I filed it away and moved on. I'll come back to it. The build starts before you add a single layer of material. Site selection matters more than most guides acknowledge. The pile needs to sit on bare soil, not concrete, not plastic sheeting, not gravel. Ground contact allows moisture to wick upward from below when the pile dries out, and more importantly, it allows organisms from the surrounding soil to migrate into the pile from underneath as the biological succession progresses. A pile built on impermeable surface is an isolated system. A pile built on soil is a connected one. The difference shows up in how quickly the decomposer community establishes itself and how completely the pile finishes. Now the construction sequence: begin with a coarse base layer of wood chips, straw, or rough carbon material, 4 to 6 inches deep, to create airflow from the bottom. Oxygen enters a pile primarily through the sides and bottom. A compacted base blocks one of the two primary entry points. On top of the base, your first green layer, no more than 2 to 3 inches of kitchen scraps, fresh grass clippings or high nitrogen material spread evenly. Then a brown layer, 2 to 3 times the depth of the green layer, shredded dry leaves, torn cardboard, wood chips, mixed in, rather than laid flat. Then a dusting of finished compost or garden soil as a biological inoculant. Then water, applied evenly until the entire section feels like a wrung-out sponge. Repeat, layer, counterlayer, inoculant, water, continue until the pile reaches at least 3 feet in height. 3 feet is the minimum. Below that, the pile lacks the insulating mass to retain the heat the organisms generate. The biology produces heat in the center, and the outer layers act as insulation. Too small a pile and heat escapes faster than it's generated. The center warms, the organisms respond, but the pile can't sustain the temperature necessary for thermophilic activity. You get a warm pile instead of a hot one, and warm composting is slow composting. Weeks become months, weed seeds survive, pathogens survive, and the finished product carries biological risks that a properly hot pile eliminates. You push a hand fork into the center of the pile on day 2. You pull it out and hold it near your palm. It should feel like a mug of hot tea against your hand. Not warm, hot, uncomfortable to hold close to skin. That is 130 degrees minimum. That is your confirmation that thermophilic bacteria have taken over from the mesophilic population that dominated the first 24 hours, and the pile is now running at the biological pace that 4 to 8 week composting requires. If it doesn't feel that hot, one of three things is wrong. The ratio is off toward too much carbon, the moisture is insufficient, or the pile is too small to retain heat. Add nitrogen, fresh grass clippings, kitchen scraps, a diluted urine application, and turn the pile to reintroduce oxygen and redistribute moisture. In most cases, that single intervention triggers visible heating within 12 to 24 hours. The high-stakes failure here is letting a pile sit lukewarm and assuming time will complete what heat was supposed to accomplish. A pile that peaks at 110 degrees rather than 140 doesn't kill weed seeds. Most require sustained temperatures of 131 degrees or higher to lose viability. It doesn't reliably eliminate pathogens. It produces compost that looks finished and isn't. The chapter on finished compost covers what that costs when you apply it to beds. Every week, a pile sits below thermophilic temperature is a week of biological potential being converted at a fraction of the rate a correctly built pile would manage. 6 weeks becomes 12, 12 becomes 20, and the output, whenever it arrives, is a lesser product than the one a properly managed pile delivers. Turn the pile every 3 to 5 days during the active phase. Each turn does three things simultaneously: reintroduces oxygen to the core, moves the cooler outer material into the hot center where it can decompose, and redistributes moisture throughout the pile. After each turn, the pile should reheat within 24 hours if the ratio and moisture are in range. If it doesn't reheat, assess moisture first, add water if the material feels dry when squeezed, then nitrogen if moisture isn't the issue. That asymmetry in the second pile I built. Right half at 147, left half at 91. I figured it out 2 years later when I was reading about moisture distribution in static piles, and something clicked. The wood chip pile against the fence was shading the left side from afternoon sun, not dramatically, but enough that moisture on that side wasn't evaporating at the same rate. The right side was drying slightly faster, which meant better oxygen penetration and a more hospitable environment for aerobic thermophilic bacteria. The left side retained more moisture, tipped slightly wet, and the oxygen balance suffered. Same materials, same ratio, same construction, one variable in moisture management created a 40-degree differential in peak temperature across a 4-foot pile. Moisture is not a set-it-and-forget-it variable. It shifts as the pile heats, as weather changes, as the materials break down and release or absorb water at different rates. A pile that's turning well and smelling right needs a moisture check every time you turn it. The wrung-out sponge test. Squeeze a handful of material from the center. It should hold together when compressed and release a drop or two of water, not stream, not drip freely, just a drop or two when held tight. That's the range. Dripping wet is too much. Crumbling dry is not enough. Here is your question. Hot composting at its best produces finished compost in 4 weeks that a passive pile might need a year to generate. Same inputs, same output, a fraction of the time. If the method is this effective and the steps are this learnable, why does hot composting remain a minority practice while slow, cold, passive piling stays the default? Is that a failure of education, a failure of patience, or something about the way we've decided that the garden should be low maintenance even when low maintenance produces low results? Chapter 1. Inoculants. Seeding microbial life into the pile. The pile was perfect on paper. 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, ratio built at 3-to-1 browns to greens by volume, layered correctly, watered to field capacity, sited on bare soil with good drainage, built on a Tuesday. By the following Tuesday, it hadn't moved past 94 degrees. By the Tuesday after that, nothing had changed. The material looked the same, smelled faintly of the inputs, nothing offensive, nothing earthy either, just the neutral waiting smell of things that haven't started becoming something else yet. No heat, no biology. A structurally perfect pile, with nothing alive enough inside it to do the work. This happens more often than you'd expect, especially on properties that have been managed conventionally, where soil has been repeatedly treated with synthetic fertilizers that suppress microbial communities, where herbicides have moved through the system, where no compost or organic amendment has been applied in years. The pile has the carbon, it has the nitrogen, it has the moisture and the oxygen. What it doesn't have, in sufficient density to trigger thermophilic activity, is the biological community that converts all those inputs into heat. This is what an inoculant solves, not a product. A biological introduction, the deliberate seeding of a new pile with an established microbial community capable of colonizing the inputs and multiplying to the densities that drive composting. One thing I noticed on a property I helped set up a composting system on, several years into running my own, the pile they built in the middle of a lawn that had been conventionally maintained for 15 years took 10 days to show any meaningful heat. The pile I built in my own yard, with soil from beds I'd been amending with compost for 6 years, heated to 138 degrees in 36 hours. Same construction method, same approximate ratio. The difference was in the inoculant, specifically, in what was and wasn't living in the soil each pile was built on and seeded from. I filed the comparison away and didn't fully process what it told me until much later in the season. An inoculant, in practical composting terms, is any material that introduces living organisms into a new pile in sufficient quantity to establish and sustain biological activity. The most accessible and effective options are also the cheapest, which fits the $0 framework perfectly. Finished compost from a previous batch is the gold standard inoculant for hot composting. It carries bacteria, fungi, and actinomycetes in an established community that has already adapted to the composting environment. A thin layer, 1 to 2 inches, worked between every 2 to 3 layers of a new pile, seeds the entire structure with organisms ready to begin metabolizing immediately. The pile doesn't need to build its population from scratch. It starts with a functioning community and scales it up. Healthy garden soil from a bed that has been composted for at least 2 to 3 years is nearly as effective. It carries a diverse microbial community adapted to your specific local conditions, your climate, your inputs, your water chemistry. That local adaptation is an underappreciated advantage. Organisms that have already been thriving in your garden's specific conditions will perform better in your pile than organisms introduced from a commercial product manufactured in a different climate under controlled conditions. Forest floor material, the dark, crumbly layer just below the leaf litter on undisturbed woodland floor, is one of the most microbiologically diverse inoculants available anywhere. If you have access to mature woodland, a few gallons of that material worked into a new pile introduces fungal networks, bacterial communities, and invertebrate populations that a garden soil may lack. Use it sparingly. A little goes a long way, but don't underestimate what it carries. The technical rule of thumb on inoculant quantity, roughly 10% of the pile's total volume in inoculant material, is sufficient to establish biological activity in most cases. More doesn't hurt, but less than 5% may not provide enough colonization density to trigger rapid heating, especially in a pile built on depleted soil with low ambient microbial activity. The cost of skipping inoculation on a pile built in biologically depleted conditions is time, specifically, the lag phase, which is the period between pile construction and the onset of thermophilic activity. In a well-inoculated pile built on living soil, the lag phase runs 24 to 48 hours. In an uninoculated pile in depleted conditions, it can run 1 to 2 weeks. During that lag phase, the pile is not inert. Mesophilic bacteria are slowly colonizing available surfaces. The population is building toward the density required for thermophilic activity, but it is not composting at the rate or temperature that hot composting is designed to achieve. 2 weeks of lag phase is 2 weeks added to every batch you produce. Over the course of a growing season, that adds up to a batch you didn't get. That property with the 15-year conventional lawn, the pile that took 10 days to heat. By the time we finished the second batch, this time with a generous inoculant of finished compost from my own operation worked in between every other layer, it heated to 129 degrees in 52 hours. Same property, same inputs, same builder. The biology made the difference. There is a category of commercial microbial inoculants, products sold as compost starters or pile activators that contain concentrated populations of specific bacterial and fungal species. Research published in peer-reviewed composting literature indicates these products can meaningfully shorten the lag phase and improve decomposition of lignocellulosic materials compared to uninoculated control piles, particularly in cold or biologically depleted starting conditions. They are not fraudulent, but they are also not necessary when finished compost, healthy garden soil, or forest floor material is available, and those free alternatives introduce broader microbial diversity than any commercial formulation currently on the market. Diversity is the variable commercial products can't replicate. An established compost or a living forest floor carries hundreds of interacting species. A commercial inoculant carries a curated selection of a few dozen. The pile that eventually tells you your inoculant worked doesn't announce itself loudly. There is a morning, usually the second or third day after construction, when you approach it and something is different before you do anything else. A faint warmth near the surface, a smell that is no longer neutral, not ammonia, not the input smell, something earthier, something more complex, something that didn't exist in the pile 24 hours earlier. That smell is your inoculant working. That is the biological community establishing itself in the new material and beginning the succession that, if you manage it correctly, will produce finished compost 6 weeks from now. Here is your question. Every effective inoculant in this chapter is free, locally available, and more biologically diverse than anything sold in a bag. If that's true, and it is, what does it tell us about the relationship between the commercial garden supply industry and the knowledge that would make most of its products unnecessary? Chapter J. Johnson Sue BR Reactor. Fungal Dominant Composting for Deep Soil Biology. Two beds, side by side, built from the same soil, planted on the same day with the same variety. One has received hot compost amendments for 3 years. The other has received nothing but Johnson Sue Bioreactor compost for the same 3 years, applied at a fraction of the volume. The hot compost bed is productive, good yield, healthy plants, responsive to inputs. The Johnson Sue bed looks like a different garden. The soil is darker, by a visible degree. The plant roots, when you pull a spent tomato plant at the end of season, come out of the ground with a structure attached to them, white, thread-like, fine-branched, that clings to the soil in a way that roots in the hot compost bed don't. The yield is comparable, but the soil behavior is fundamentally different. It holds moisture longer, it crumbles differently in the hand. Something in it has changed at a level that nutrient amendments alone don't explain. The difference is fungal biology, and the Johnson Sue Bioreactor is the tool that produces it. Developed by Dr. David C. Johnson and Huichun Sue Johnson in the early 2000s, the Johnson Sue Bioreactor is a composting method designed not primarily to generate heat or speed decomposition, but to cultivate a microbially diverse, fungal-dominant biological community in the finished product. It operates on principles almost opposite to hot composting. No turning, no heat management, high moisture maintained throughout, and a structure built specifically to keep the internal environment cool enough for fungi to proliferate without competition from thermophilic bacteria. Most degraded agricultural soils, soils that have been tilled repeatedly, treated with synthetic fertilizers and herbicides, or left without organic matter for extended periods, are bacteria dominant. Their bacterial populations are intact, but their fungal communities are depleted. Bacteria and fungi serve different ecological functions in soil. Bacteria are specialists in processing simple, soluble nutrients and are the dominant force in disturbed, low organic matter environments. Fungi build structural relationships with plant roots through mycorrhizal networks, with recalcitrant carbon through lignin-degrading enzymes, with the soil matrix through the hyphal networks that physically bind soil particles together. Depleted fungal biology means soil that doesn't hold structure, doesn't retain moisture efficiently, and doesn't form the plant-fungi partnerships that extend effective root systems and improve drought resistance. Something a neighbor mentioned in passing last spring, while we were talking over the fence about soil amendments, her grandmother's kitchen garden, the one that had been in continuous production for 40 years without ever receiving a synthetic input, produced consistently heavier harvests than anything she'd managed on the same property in 20 years of modern practice. The grandmother had composted with a pile in the corner that she never turned, never monitored temperature, just added material and waited. A year, sometimes more, before pulling from it. She didn't know it, but she was running a fungal-dominant system. The pile had never gotten hot enough to suppress fungal communities. I filed that away and thought about it later. The bioreactor build is simpler than it sounds. A cylindrical structure, wire mesh, wood frame, or stacked rings of woven material, approximately 3 to 4 feet in diameter and 4 to 5 feet tall. Vertical aeration pipes, made from perforated PVC or bamboo, run from the base to the top at regular intervals around the circumference, allowing passive airflow without mechanical turning. These pipes are the critical structural element. They replace the oxygen delivery function that turning provides in hot composting, allowing aerobic conditions to be maintained in a static pile that is never disturbed. The pile is loaded with high-carbon woody material, wood chips, straw, dry leaves, spent garden plant stems, with nitrogen material layered in at roughly the same 3-to-1 ratio as hot composting. Moisture is maintained at approximately 70% higher than a hot pile, deliberately so, because fungi require sustained moisture to develop and spread their hyphal networks through the material. The pile is watered regularly, covered with a permeable material to slow evaporation while allowing airflow, and left completely undisturbed for a minimum of 12 months. No turning, no temperature monitoring, no intervention. This is where the method asks the most of people who have been trained to manage their compost actively. 12 months of leaving something alone feels, in the early stages, like neglect. The pile won't steam, it won't shrink dramatically. It won't show the visible signs of activity that a hot pile produces within the first week. What it will do, in the interior of the structure, where conditions stay moist and cool, and aerobically stable, is develop a biological community of extraordinary density and diversity, one that commercial research has found can be applied at concentrations as low as 1 kilogram per hectare, and still function as an effective microbial inoculant, introducing beneficial organisms to soil in a ratio that changes how the soil behaves rather than merely adding nutrients to it. That is the fundamental difference between hot compost and Johnson Soup compost in application. Hot compost primarily delivers nutrients and organic matter. It feeds the soil and improves its physical structure. Johnson Soup compost primarily delivers biology. It seeds the soil with a functional microbial community capable of establishing itself and operating independently once the amendment is incorporated. Hot compost is fertility. Johnson Soup is ecosystem restoration. For a garden that is already producing adequately, but whose soil feels dead or compacted or unresponsive, the kind of soil where organic matter doesn't seem to persist, where earthworm populations are low, where plants establish slowly, regardless of nutrient inputs, Johnson Soup compost is not a supplement to hot composting. It's the intervention that addresses what hot composting can't. The high-stakes failure specific to the Johnson Soup method is impatience. The most common way people abandon the bioreactor is by pulling from it at 3 or 4 months when the outer layer looks like it might be usable before the fungal community in the core has had time to establish and mature. Immature Johnson Soup compost applied to beds delivers incompletely developed biology and may actually introduce compounds from incomplete fungal decomposition that temporarily affect soil chemistry. The 12-month timeline is not conservative caution. It is the biological minimum for the fungal succession to run its full course. The neighbor's grandmother. The pile that never got hot. 40 years of production, consistently heavier harvests, without a single synthetic input. The pile she never turned was doing something that none of the managed, monitored, deliberately optimized systems her granddaughter ran for 20 years managed to replicate. The fungal community in that undisturbed pile was probably the most biologically diverse amendment that garden ever received, and neither the woman adding to it nor the one who inherited the property understood what it was or why it worked. You don't need to understand a system fully to benefit from it, but you benefit more when you do. Here is your question. The Johnson Soup bioreactor produces a finished product that operates more as a living soil inoculant than a conventional amendment, something applied in tiny quantities that changes how soil functions for years, not seasons. If that kind of biological restoration is achievable at zero cost with a wire cylinder, a year of patience, and material you already have, what does that say about where the real leverage in soil improvement actually lives, and why almost no mainstream gardening advice points toward it? Chapter K. Kitchen Scraps. What goes in and what stays out? The raccoons found it on a Thursday night. By Friday morning, the bin was on its side, the contents spread across 12 feet of yard, and something-something with teeth and determination had dug a trench through the center of what had been, 3 days earlier, a carefully layered pile, leftover chicken bones, the tail end of a block of cheese, a container of bacon grease someone had scraped in rather than dealt with properly. All of it was gone. What remained was a scatter of kitchen scraps, dry leaves, and a pile structure that would take a weekend to rebuild. The person who told me this story, a woman at a composting workshop I attended years ago, said the worst part wasn't the mess, it was that she'd known better. She'd heard the rule about meat and dairy. She'd added it anyway because it seemed wasteful to throw it out when the pile was right there. One shortcut. One Thursday night. The raccoons had been back 3 times since. Kitchen scraps are the most personal category in the composting system. They're what you produce daily. In the smallest quantities, from the most intimate part of your household, the kitchen, the table, the end of every meal, they're also the category where most new composters make the mistakes that create the most visible, most discouraging, and most easily preventable problems. This chapter is about those mistakes and about building the habit of knowing without thinking what goes in the bucket and what goes somewhere else. The foundational rule is this: plant-based kitchen waste composts cleanly. Animal-based kitchen waste attracts pests, creates odor, and introduces pathogens into the pile that a backyard hot compost system cannot reliably eliminate. That distinction, plant versus animal, is the dividing line. Everything on the plant side goes in. Nearly everything on the animal side stays out. Something I noticed while cleaning out my bin one spring, a film of white residue coating the inner wall of the compost bucket near the bottom, thin, faintly sticky, with a smell that was neither rotten nor fresh, but something between the two. I wiped it out, dismissed it as normal residue, and moved on. It was there again the following week, and the week after. It didn't cause any obvious problem that season. I'll come back to what it was. On the plant side, the list of what composts well is long and forgiving. Vegetable peels and scraps of every kind, potato, carrot, squash, beet, onion in moderate quantities, fruit scraps, rinds and cores, coffee grounds and paper filters, loose tea and paper tea bags, remove the staples, stale bread and plain grains in small quantities, buried deep in the pile rather than left near the surface where they attract rodents, cooked plain rice or pasta occasionally, and in small amounts, again buried, rather than surface applied. Eggshells, they add calcium, break down slowly, and are worth crushing before adding to increase surface area and speed the process. The items that consistently generate the most confusion, citrus peels. The claim that citrus is toxic to compost or kills worms circulates widely and is largely unsupported. In moderate quantities, a few peels at a time, not an entire batch of juicing waste added at once, citrus composts without issue in a hot pile. Large quantities of citrus added together can introduce enough essential oils to temporarily suppress microbial activity and affect soil pH if used in a small worm bin, but spread across a hot pile over time, citrus is a non-issue. Same guidance for onion and garlic. Moderate quantities are fine. Large concentrated additions introduce sulfur compounds and antimicrobial properties that can slow the pile locally. The practical rule is variety, no single item in large concentrated batches. What stays out, without exception, meat, fish, and bones. They decompose slowly, produce the specific odors that attract raccoons, opossums, rats, and dogs, and can introduce pathogens including salmonella and E. coli into a system that may not reach the sustained temperatures needed to neutralize them. Dairy products, cheese, butter, yogurt, milk follow the same logic: slow decomposition, pest-attracting odor, pathogen risk. Fats, oils, and grease coat organic material and prevent it from decomposing properly, create anaerobic pockets, and produce odors that alert every opportunistic omnivore within a significant radius. These materials are not the enemy of composting in principle. Industrial composting facilities process them routinely, but a backyard pile at 3 feet by 3 feet is not an industrial facility. The conditions that make meat and dairy safe to compost, sustained high heat throughout the entire mass, reliable pathogen destruction, are difficult to guarantee in a system you're managing on weekends. The high-stakes failure in kitchen scrap management is not a single catastrophic addition. It is a habit of casual exceptions. The occasional chicken bone, the small amount of cooking grease, the dairy that would otherwise go to waste. Each individual addition may not create a visible problem. Cumulatively, over weeks, they build toward the conditions that bring pests. And once a pest population has identified your pile as a food source, it will return regardless of whether the problematic inputs continue. Pest problems that follow a composting system into the neighbor's property, into a rental situation, or onto a property with children create social and practical consequences that a correctly managed pile would never generate. The cost of a single wrong addition, on the right night, with the wrong wildlife population in the area, is the entire pile structure and the trust of whoever else shares the property. The white film in the bucket. The faintly sticky residue with the in-between smell. I eventually traced it to a habit I developed of rinsing the compost bucket with a small amount of dish soap before refilling it, just a few drops, not enough to notice. The soap residue was coating the bottom, mixing with food acids from the scraps, and creating a mildly anaerobic film in the base of the bucket that made every batch of scraps it held slightly less aerobic than it should have been by the time it reached the pile. The fix was rinsing with plain water only, and keeping the bucket dry between uses. A small thing, but it was happening twice a week, every week, for an entire season, before I caught it. Here is your question. The line between what composts safely and what doesn't in a backyard system is essentially the line between plant-based and animal-based food waste. If that's the rule, and it is, why do so many composting guides hedge it with exceptions and qualifications rather than stating it plainly? Is that nuance genuinely useful to a beginner? Or does it create the ambiguity that leads to the Thursday night raccoon visit? Chapter L. Layering. The art and logic of building a pile correctly. There is a pile that has been sitting in the back corner of the yard for 6 months, and it smells like the bottom of a trash can. Not composting, not ammonia sharp, something lower and wetter, a slow, sulfurous rot that hangs in the air on warm days and makes the area near it unpleasant to work in. The pile is the right size, the materials are the right materials, vegetable scraps, dry leaves, grass clippings, cardboard, everything on the approved list. And yet the outcome is this: a wet, airless, odorous mass that has not noticeably composted and that everyone involved has quietly stopped adding to because approaching it feels like a punishment. The failure is not in the materials, it is in the construction. Specifically, in the absence of any construction at all. Everything was added together, in bulk, in no particular order or proportion, and what was created was not a compost pile, it was a dump. Layering is the architectural decision that separates a pile that functions as a managed biological system from a pile that functions as a slow anaerobic decomposition heap. It is not complicated, it is not time-consuming. It takes less than a minute per addition once the habit is established, and it changes every outcome the pile produces: heat generation, decomposition speed, odor, biological diversity, and the quality of the finished product. The logic behind layering is the logic of the carbon-to-nitrogen ratio made physical. Every green addition, kitchen scraps, fresh grass clippings, plant trimmings, needs a brown counterpart in proportion, roughly 3 times its volume in carbon-rich material mixed in alongside it. Layering is how that proportion gets maintained in practice, addition by addition, rather than being approximated once at the beginning and abandoned as the pile grows. A pile built by layering maintains its ratio throughout its depth. A pile built by random addition drifts, hot and nitrogen-heavy in the sections where scraps were added in bulk, cold and carbon-heavy in the sections where leaves were dumped without a corresponding nitrogen input. The first addition I ever made to a pile that genuinely worked, I remember the exact sequence I used because someone had walked me through it at a garden exchange that spring. I had a bucket of kitchen scraps, heavy, wet, high nitrogen. I started with a coarse base of dry stalky material, already in place from the previous week. I spread the scraps in a layer no deeper than 2 to 3 inches across the full surface area of the pile, rather than dumped in one spot. On top of that, a layer of shredded dry leaves, roughly 3 times the depth of the scraps. Then a light dusting of finished compost from the base of an older pile, the inoculant layer. Then water, applied with a watering can rather than a hose, moving slowly across the surface until the top layer felt damp but not streaming. That was the addition. It took 4 minutes. The pile heated to 128 degrees by the following morning. There is something about the sequence that I noticed on that occasion and didn't think about for months: the stalky material at the very base of the pile, thick-stemmed spent sunflowers from the previous season that I'd chopped roughly and laid crosswise, was still almost entirely intact 6 weeks later when I pulled finished compost from the bottom of the pile. Everything above it had composted completely. The base layer was still recognizable. I pulled it out and added it to the new pile. I'll come back to what that told me. The layering sequence that works consistently begins at the base. Coarse, stalky, structural material, chopped woody stems, wood chips, rough straw, 6 to 8 inches deep. This base layer does 2 things. It elevates the green layers above any pooling moisture that collects at the pile's base, and it creates the upward airflow channel that oxygen needs to move through the pile from the bottom. A pile that compresses against bare soil with no coarse base layer loses its bottom airflow within days as moisture and weight compress the lowest layers. The anaerobic zone begins from the bottom up. Above the base, alternating layers of greens and browns, never more than 2 to 3 inches of green material at a time, followed immediately by the brown counterpart before the next green addition goes in. The browns are not added after the greens are in place for a week. They go in immediately, in the same session, as part of the same construction sequence. Every addition follows this pattern. Not sometimes, every time. Kitchen scraps go in the center of the pile, buried under the brown layer, not left on the surface. Surface scraps are visible to wildlife, dry out in sun and wind rather than decomposing, and attract fruit flies and other insects that are a nuisance rather than a benefit. Buried scraps are insulated, maintain moisture, have immediate contact with the brown layer above and below them, and decompose in the aerobic, temperature-stable environment at the pile's core. The cost of unstructured pile management, everything added together, no sequence, no proportional layering, is not just slower composting. It's a pile that actively works against you. The anaerobic zones created by thick, unmixed green layers produce hydrogen sulfide and the sulfurous, garbage-adjacent smell that makes composting unpopular with neighbors, partners, and landlords. The compressed, airless sections take months to break down and produce material that is partly finished and partly raw when it finally comes out. Applied to beds, that inconsistent material behaves like unfinished compost, competing with plants for nitrogen, introducing weed seeds from sections that never got hot, creating uneven soil chemistry across the same planting area. The stalky base layer that survived completely intact after 6 weeks while everything above it finished, what it told me, eventually, was that decomposition in a hot pile runs faster in the moist, warm, biologically active middle sections than it does in the structural base, which stays cooler and drier. The base layer was functioning as an airflow scaffold rather than as compost feedstock. For it to decompose, it needed to move up into the active zone, which it did when I added it to the next pile as a middle layer rather than another base. Within 4 weeks, what had spent 6 weeks as unchanged structural material was gone. Same inputs, different position, different outcome. Layering determines not just the ratio, but the environment every material experiences inside the pile. Here is your question. Layering takes roughly 4 minutes per addition, and the difference between a layered pile and an unlayered one is the difference between finished compost in 6 weeks and a sulfurous heap after 6 months. If the intervention is that small and the outcome difference is that large, why is just add it to the pile still the default advice most new composters receive? Chapter M. Moisture. The most overlooked variable in composting. The pile is 3 weeks into its second turn cycle, and the thermometer reads 97 degrees. 3 days ago, it read 138. The turn should have reheated it. You moved the outer material to the center, redistributed everything evenly, checked the ratio, added a small amount of nitrogen to compensate for any loss. By all accounts, everything was done correctly, but the pile cooled instead of reheating, and it has been cooling for 3 days. The material in the center looks right, smells right, feels structurally correct. You pull a handful from the core and squeeze it hard. Nothing, not a drop. The material crumbles dry between your fingers like breadcrumbs. The pile has dehydrated. Not visibly, it doesn't look desiccated. It doesn't have the pale, dusty appearance of material that has never been wet. But the moisture content has dropped below the threshold where aerobic microbial activity can sustain itself, and the organisms driving your decomposition have slowed to near dormancy. Thermophilic bacteria require moisture content between 40 and 60% by weight to remain metabolically active. Below 40%, activity drops sharply. The pile doesn't die, it waits. Moisture is the variable most composting guides treat as secondary. Mention the wrung-out sponge test, advise watering when dry, and move on to the ratio or the turning schedule. In practice, moisture management is as consequential as ratio management and more demanding because it changes constantly. The pile loses moisture every day through evaporation, biological activity, and the heat it generates. A hot pile composting aggressively can lose roughly 1% of its moisture content per day in warm, dry weather. Over a week of summer heat, that is 7 to 10% moisture loss, enough to move a pile from optimal range to suboptimal, from active to stalling, without any single dramatic event to trace it back to. One thing I noticed in the second summer, I ran a pile through a dry stretch in late July. A section of the pile near the base of one wall of the wire bin had finished more completely than the rest, darker, crumblier, clearly further along than the surrounding material. The rest of the pile had slowed and cooled as the drought stretched into its third week. That corner section had continued working. I noted it and forgot about it. The following summer, the same pattern appeared. Same location, same dry conditions, same corner finishing ahead of everything else. I'll come back to why. The optimal moisture range for thermophilic composting is between 50 and 65% by weight, a range that has a clear physical indicator without any measurement equipment, the wrung-out sponge test. Take a handful of material from the pile's center, compress it firmly in your fist. At optimal moisture, the material holds together when compressed and releases one or two drops of water when you squeeze hard, not a stream, not a trickle, just one or two drops. Below that range, the material crumbles rather than cohering. Above that range, water streams or drips freely, and the pile is approaching the saturation threshold where oxygen is displaced and anaerobic conditions develop. The wrung-out sponge test is fast, free, and accurate enough for field management. Do it every time you turn the pile. Do it between turns during dry weather, particularly in summer. A pile that has been heating actively can dry out in under a week in hot, low humidity conditions, and a moisture check costs 30 seconds. Restoring a dehydrated pile is straightforward. Water slowly across the full surface, allowing each section to absorb before the next application. A hose on low pressure runs slowly across the top is more effective than a high-pressure stream that runs off rather than penetrating the pile's structure. Watering in the evening reduces immediate evaporation loss. After watering, turn the pile to distribute moisture evenly through the interior. The center of an active pile is typically drier than the outer layers because heat-driven evaporation moves moisture outward and upward. The center needs water more urgently than the exterior suggests. Overwatering is the opposite failure and produces opposite symptoms. A saturated pile, moisture content above 65 to 70%, loses the air pockets that aerobic organisms depend on. The anaerobic bacteria that move into oxygen-depleted zones produce sulfurous, rotting smells rather than the earthy notes of a healthy aerobic pile. The pile compresses, heats inconsistently, and may develop an outer crust of dried material over a wet, airless interior that insulates the problem from view. A pile that smells like a swamp after heavy rain has been overwatered, and the fix is the same as with any anaerobic condition. Turn aggressively, add dry brown material to absorb excess moisture and restore structure, and allow drainage before the next water application. The high-stakes failure of chronic moisture mismanagement runs below the surface in a way that's easy to miss season after season. A pile that repeatedly cycles between dehydration and oversaturation, drying out between infrequent watering sessions, then getting waterlogged when it rains, produces a biological community that never stabilizes long enough to run a complete decomposition cycle at peak efficiency. The organisms establish, slow, re-establish, and slow again with each moisture swing. The pile takes longer, the output is more variable. The finished product, when it finally arrives, reflects the inconsistency of the conditions it was produced in. Uneven texture, inconsistent nutrient density, biological activity that was interrupted repeatedly rather than sustained. Applied across two or three seasons, that kind of chronic underperformance represents a meaningful loss of soil building capacity that is entirely within your control to prevent. The pile didn't fail to produce good compost because the inputs were wrong or the ratio was off. It failed because no one checked the moisture consistently, and moisture doesn't announce its problems loudly until the pile is already far out of range, that corner of the pile that finished ahead of everything else during the dry spells. Two summers in a row, same location, same pattern. What was different about that corner? The water barrel I kept beside the bin for hand watering the garden was positioned directly above that section of the pile, and its base connection dripped. A slow, consistent drip, maybe a half gallon a day, that I'd noticed and never gotten around to fixing. That slow leak was delivering regular distributed moisture to one section of the pile throughout the drought, while the rest dehydrated and stalled. The pile had been telling me what it needed for two summers. I'd been looking at it as a plumbing problem. Here is your question. Moisture is the most controllable variable in composting, more responsive to management than ratio, faster to correct than biological balance, simpler to monitor than temperature. If that's true, and a pile that stalls from dehydration or saturation is always a choice that could have been prevented, what does it say about how most of us actually pay attention to living systems we've taken responsibility for? Chapter N. No-cost bin builds, pallets, wire circles, and found materials. The bin cost $230. Injection-molded black plastic, tapered sides, a twist-off lid, a small sliding door at the base for extracting finished compost. The catalog described it as the complete composting solution. It arrived in a flat box with 27 parts and an instruction sheet that took 40 minutes to decipher. When fully assembled, it held approximately 40 gallons of material, roughly a third of the volume needed to sustain thermophilic composting, had no side ventilation, and trapped moisture so effectively that every batch produced in it came out partially anaerobic, smelling faintly of fermentation, and requiring an additional month of open-air curing before it was safe to put near plant roots. The neighbor's three-section pallet bin, built on a Saturday morning from seven pallets pulled from behind a grocery store, connected at the corners with galvanized wire, sitting on bare soil, costing nothing, was producing finished hot compost in 6 weeks. It had been doing so for 4 years. The composting industry has a significant financial interest in the idea that composting requires a purchased container. It does not. The biology that transforms organic waste into finished soil amendment does not require plastic walls, a twist-off lid, or a sliding extraction door. It requires the right volume of material, adequate airflow, proper moisture, and the ratio management the previous chapters have covered in detail. The container's job is to hold the material in place, allow air movement, and provide enough mass for heat retention. Those functions can be achieved with pallets, wire, and materials available free on almost any property. Something I noticed the first winter, I ran a wire circle bin alongside a covered plastic bin, both loaded with similar material, built the same week, managed identically. The wire circle composted noticeably faster through the first month, then slowed in late December when temperatures dropped and the open structure stopped retaining heat. The plastic bin composted slower overall, but maintained a narrow band of biological activity through the coldest weeks that the wire circle couldn't match. I filed the comparison away and kept watching. I'll come back to what that trade-off means in practical terms. The simplest functional bin is a wire circle, hardware cloth, the galvanized mesh with half-inch or one-inch openings or welded wire fencing, cut to approximately 10 feet in length, formed into a cylinder and fastened at the seam with wire clips or cable ties, produces a bin roughly 3 feet in diameter. That diameter, if the pile is built to 3 feet high, gives you a volume close to the minimum needed for reliable thermophilic activity. The wire circle costs nothing if you have fencing material available, and under $10 in wire clips even if you buy new hardware cloth. It takes 15 minutes to build. To turn the pile, you unfasten the seam, pull the cylinder away from the pile, reposition it alongside the loose material, and fork everything back in. Turning requires no bin modifications, no special tools, and creates a genuinely efficient mixing action because you're reforming the pile from scratch each time rather than working around a fixed structure. The pallet bin is the step up from the wire circle, and it performs better for serious year-round composting. 7 pallets build a 3-section system. One section for active composting, one for a pile in its curing phase, and one for storing brown material that will handle the waste stream of most households indefinitely. The pallets are connected at the corners, with galvanized wire wound through the pallet slats, or with 3-inch deck screws if you have a drill available. No concrete anchoring, no foundation. The structure stands on its own weight and can be disassembled and relocated in under an hour if needed. Pallets are available free from grocery stores, garden centers, hardware stores, and distribution warehouses. Call ahead and ask. Most locations set them aside rather than paying to dispose of them. One critical distinction on pallets: check the stamp. Pallets marked HT, heat treated, are safe for composting use. Pallets marked MB, methyl bromide treated, have been fumigated with a pesticide and should never be used in a food growing context. The HT or MB stamp is typically on the side block of the pallet, in small branded lettering. HT pallets are by far the more common in North American circulation. MB pallets have been largely phased out of domestic use, but still appear occasionally in import supply chains. The high-stakes failure in no-cost bin construction is building too small. The two most common improvised bin sizes, a single pallet square and a small wire circle under 2 feet in diameter, are both below the volume threshold for sustained thermophilic activity. A single pallet square is approximately 3.5 feet wide, but often only fills to 2 feet of height before material falls through the gaps. A small wire circle may have the diameter, but lack the height. In both cases, the pile has insufficient insulating mass to retain the heat its biological activity generates, and the result is a pile that warms slightly, never reaches thermophilic temperature, composts slowly, and produces material indistinguishable in quality or timeline from cold, passive decomposition. You've built a structure but not a system. The minimum volume for reliable hot composting is 1 cubic yard, 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. Everything below that threshold is a cold pile with walls. Building to that volume from the start, even if it means waiting until you have enough material to fill it properly rather than starting with a partial pile, produces dramatically different results than the common practice of adding a little at a time to a bin that never reaches functional volume. That wire circle in winter, slower than the covered plastic bin during the coldest weeks. What the comparison told me eventually was that bin choice is climate dependent in ways most guides don't acknowledge. In a mild or warm climate, a wire circle outperforms a covered plastic bin across every metric: faster decomposition, better aeration, easier turning, zero cost, indefinite service life. In a cold climate, genuine cold, Below freezing for weeks at a time, the open structure loses heat faster than it generates it in the deep winter months, and a covered structure that retains some warmth will maintain biological activity through periods when the wire circle goes dormant. The right bin is not a universal answer. It's the answer for your climate and your season. Here is your question. A three-section pallet bin outperforms a $200 injection molded plastic composter by every practical metric: volume, airflow, accessibility, service life, and cost. If a homesteader knows that and buys the plastic bin anyway, is that a failure of information, a failure of confidence in what Free and Simple can produce, or something about the way we've been taught to associate cost with quality, even when the evidence runs the other way? Chapter 0. Oxygen. Why turning the pile is non-negotiable. The smell hits you before you reach the gate. Not ammonia, something lower than that, something that sits in the back of the throat with a weight to it. Sulfur, rot, the specific smell of a biological process that ran out of oxygen and kept going without it. You open the gate and the pile is black and wet and compressed, a solid mass that doesn't crumble at the edge when you push it with your boot. It holds together like clay, airless and cold at the center, despite having been built 6 weeks ago with the right ratio, the right moisture, the right inputs. Your neighbor is at her window. She's been at her window about the pile before. An anaerobic pile is not a composting pile that has stalled. It is a pile that has crossed into a different biological process entirely, one that produces different organisms, different chemical byproducts, and a fundamentally different end product than the aerobic decomposition this entire system is designed to manage. Anaerobic bacteria decompose organic matter, but they do it slowly, incompletely, and with outputs that include methane, hydrogen sulfide, the sulfur smell, and organic acids that suppress the very organisms you need to bring the pile back to health. The pile is not resting. It has been colonized by a different community, running a different process, and turning it back toward aerobic decomposition requires more than patience. It requires oxygen, immediately, in quantity. Aerobic composting bacteria, the mesophilic and thermophilic organisms responsible for every degree of heat a functional pile generates, require oxygen concentrations above 5% to remain metabolically active at the rates necessary for hot composting. In an active pile, biological activity consumes available oxygen within the pile's air pockets faster than passive diffusion can replace it. After turning, oxygen levels in the pile interior can drop back below functional thresholds within 30 to 45 minutes as the microbial community consumes the reintroduced air. This is why the turning schedule matters as much as the single turn. It's not a one-time reset. It's an ongoing oxygen delivery system for a biological community that consumes its atmosphere faster than it can be passively replenished. Something a soil scientist mentioned in a talk I attended years into running my own composting operation. She described a static pile managed without turning as not a failed compost pile, but as a successful anaerobic digester. Same inputs, different oxygen management. Entirely different biological community, different outputs, different chemistry. She said it clinically, as a fact. I sat with it for the rest of the talk and most of the drive home. I'll come back to what she meant. The practical turning schedule for an actively hot composting pile is every 3 to 5 days during the first 2 to 3 weeks. Each turn accomplishes three things simultaneously: reintroduces oxygen to the core, where concentrations have dropped below aerobic threshold, moves cooler outer material into the hot center, where biological activity is highest, and redistributes moisture through a pile that dries unevenly as heat drives evaporation upward and outward. After each turn, a healthy pile with adequate ratio and moisture should reheat within 12 to 24 hours. If it takes longer than 24 hours to reheat after a turn, assess moisture and nitrogen before the next intervention. Those are the two variables most likely to be limiting reactivation. As the pile matures, after the first 2 to 3 weeks of active heat cycling, turning frequency can reduce to once a week or less. The thermophilic phase is winding down. The pile is transitioning from aggressive bacterial decomposition toward the slower fungal and actinomycete phase that produces the earthy smell and dark uniform texture of finishing compost. This phase needs oxygen, but not in the same urgency or quantity as the thermophilic peak. Less frequent turning at this stage supports fungal establishment. Remember the white mycelium threads from the chapter on decomposers, rather than disrupting it every few days. Here is the technique that makes a difference. Don't simply turn the pile from top to bottom. Move the outer material to a new location adjacent to the pile. Rebuild the pile starting with that outer material at the center and add the inner material around it. This inversion, outside in, rather than top to bottom, puts the coolest, least processed material at the core, where temperatures are highest and biological activity is most intense, and moves the hot, partially processed center material to the periphery, where it can rest, cool slightly, allow fungal colonization, and wait for the next turn to bring it back to center. It takes slightly more effort than a simple top-to-bottom turn. The decomposition results are measurably different. The high-stakes cost of an oxygen-deprived pile is rarely calculated in full. An anaerobic pile doesn't just compost slowly, it produces a different finished product. Anaerobic decomposition produces partially stabilized organic acids, residual sulfur compounds, and a biological community dominated by organisms that will continue their process in your soil when you apply the compost to beds. Applied too early, compost from a pile that ran anaerobic for significant periods introduces those compounds to your root zone, temporarily suppressing aerobic soil biology, creating localized soil chemistry that can affect germination and root development, when delivering lower nutrient availability than aerobic compost from the same inputs. You may not lose plants, but you may spend half a growing season wondering why a bed that should be thriving isn't, tracing it to everything except the compost you added in April. That's the cost of not turning, not the smell, though the smell is real. The quiet degradation of your soil amendment's quality, applied across multiple seasons, compounding in a direction you're not tracking. What the soil scientist meant when she said a static unturned pile is a successful anaerobic digester, the biology always does something. You cannot stop decomposition by leaving a pile alone. You can only decide what kind of decomposition you're managing. Aerobic composting, driven by turning and oxygen, produces finished compost. Anaerobic digestion, driven by oxygen exclusion, produces biogas and digestate, the same process that industrial facilities use deliberately, with captured methane and managed outputs. In a backyard pile, left to run anaerobic without intention or management, you get the outputs without the capture. The methane escapes, the hydrogen sulfide escapes, your neighbor stands at the window, and the pile produces something that is technically decomposed organic matter but bears little resemblance to what a well-managed aerobic pile delivers. Turning is not a chore, it is oxygen delivery. It is the single most consequential physical intervention in the composting process, and it takes 5 to 10 minutes per session for a pile of standard backyard scale. The question is never whether it matters. It is whether you'll do it on the schedule the biology requires rather than the schedule that's convenient. Here is your question. Turning a compost pile every 3 to 5 days during the active phase takes roughly 30 minutes a week and is the difference between finished compost in 6 weeks and an anaerobic heap that the neighbor has opinions about. If that's the trade-off, 30 minutes a week or a pile that fails, why do most composting guides present turning as optional, and what does that tell you about how the hobby gardening world prioritizes convenience over results? Chapter P. pH. Reading your compost's chemistry. The seedlings come up clean. Germination is strong, the cotyledons are the right green, and for the first week, everything looks like the start of a good season. By day 10, the true leaves are yellowing at the margins. Not tip burn, not the classic nitrogen deficiency pattern. The yellowing is intervenal, running between the leaf veins while the veins themselves stay green, which points toward a micronutrient availability problem rather than a simple nitrogen issue. The beds were freshly amended with compost before transplanting. The compost tested visually fine, dark, crumbly, smelled like earth, pH of the compost, 4.8, acidic enough to lock out iron, manganese and zinc at the root zone, even in otherwise healthy soil. The compost wasn't contaminated, it wasn't unfinished. Its pH was outside the range where those micronutrients remain plant available, and the seedlings were telling you exactly what they couldn't access in the clearest language available to a plant that can't speak. Compost pH is the variable most home composters never measure and rarely think about, because finished compost from a well-managed pile typically arrives in the range of 6 to 8, neutral to slightly alkaline, and causes no problems. But the chemistry of a compost pile changes substantially across its production cycle, and certain inputs, management failures, or climate conditions can push the finished product outside that safe range in ways that are not visible, not detectable by smell, and not correctable once the compost has been applied to beds. Understanding how pH moves through a pile's life cycle and what pushes it toward acidic or alkaline extremes is what keeps that range reliable across every batch you produce. Something I noticed in a pile, I ran one autumn with an unusually large quantity of fresh oak leaves, more than I'd typically use, added in bulk because the tree came down, and I had an abundance. The pile's early phase ran with a persistent low-level ammonia smell, despite correct ratio management. Not the sharp, eye-watering ammonia of severe nitrogen overload, something milder, more persistent, that didn't resolve the way it usually does after adding browns and turning. The pile eventually composted normally and finished well. The ammonia pattern in the early weeks didn't match anything I expected from a ratio problem. I noted it and moved on without investigating further. I'll come back to what it was. The pH of a fresh compost pile typically drops in the first few days of active decomposition. Organic acids, produced by bacteria, as they begin breaking down simple sugars and carbohydrates in the green material, accumulate in the pile's liquid phase, driving pH toward acidic conditions, sometimes to as low as 4 or 5 in the first week. This acidification phase is normal. It is also self-resolving in a healthy, actively managed pile. As bacterial activity increases and ammonia begins to accumulate as a byproduct of protein decomposition, the pH rises back toward neutral and then slightly alkaline, typically stabilizing in the 6 to 8 range by the time the thermophilic phase is fully established. The problem is when the acidification phase doesn't resolve, when the pile stays in the pH 4 to 5 range past the first 2 weeks. This happens most commonly under three conditions: inadequate aeration, keeping the pile in a fermentative rather than oxidative mode, overloading with high sugar fruit waste that generates sustained organic acid production, or excessive use of acidifying brown materials like oak leaves or pine needles in proportions high enough to overwhelm the pH buffering capacity of the pile's nitrogen inputs. A pile stuck in the acidic phase composts slowly. The thermophilic bacteria that drive hot composting have optimal activity in the pH 6 to 8 range. Below 5, their metabolism slows significantly, and the pile loses the biological momentum needed to sustain heat and complete decomposition on schedule. The result is a pile that heats briefly, cools, and then sits in a slow fermentative state that produces partially decomposed organic matter rather than finished compost and a finished product whenever it arrives that carries the residual acidity of its production conditions. The practical correction for a pile running acidic: add agricultural lime or wood ash, both alkaline, both free or low cost, in thin dustings between layers when you turn the pile. Wood ash from an untreated wood fire is available to most homesteaders for free and is particularly effective because it also provides potassium alongside its pH buffering function. A thin layer, roughly half an inch spread across the pile surface before the next brown layer, is sufficient to drive measurable pH movement over 1 to 2 turns. Do not add lime and wood ash together. Both are alkaline, and the combination can overdrive pH in the other direction, pushing above 8.5, where nitrogen volatilization accelerates and a different set of nutrient availability problems begins. At the high end, a pile running alkaline above 8. The most common culprit is excessive addition of wood ash, lime, or alkaline water source, combined with a high nitrogen pile generating substantial ammonia during active decomposition. High pH in the presence of ammonia dramatically accelerates nitrogen volatilization, which means a pile running at pH 8 and above is actively losing its nitrogen content to the atmosphere at the same time the alkalinity is reducing micronutrient availability. Two problems compounding each other, neither visible at the surface, both measurable with a simple soil pH meter pushed into the pile's core. Testing is simple. A basic soil pH meter, available for under $15, reads compost pH directly when pushed into moistened pile material. Test at the center, not the outer edge, where surface conditions create pH readings that don't reflect the bulk chemistry of the pile. Test after each turn during the thermophilic phase, when pH is most dynamic. Finished compost should read between 6.5 and 7.5 for most food-growing applications. Outside that range, investigate inputs and aeration before applying to beds. The oak leaf pile. The persistent low-level ammonia smell that didn't match a ratio problem. Oak leaves are notably high in tannic acid, with a carbon-to-nitrogen ratio that can run to 80:1 or higher depending on species and maturity. A pile loaded heavily with fresh oak leaves starts with an acidic pH baseline and high carbon content simultaneously. As the pile's thermophilic bacteria begin driving ammonia production from the nitrogen inputs, the pile's acidic pH from the oak tannins accelerates ammonia volatilization. The acidic conditions convert ammonium into free ammonia gas more efficiently than a neutral or alkaline pile would. The smell I was detecting wasn't a ratio failure. It was pH-driven volatilization. The pile was losing nitrogen because its pH baseline was running low, and the ammonia was the evidence. The pile resolved eventually because the biological succession self-corrected the pH over time, but slowly and with more nitrogen loss than a pH-managed pile would have experienced. That is what pH mismanagement costs in a compost pile: nitrogen. The most critical nutrient in the system, the one every other variable is calibrated to preserve, leaving through a chemical pathway that has nothing to do with ratio and everything to do with acidity. A pile that never gets a pH test and runs acidic for weeks is a pile quietly metabolizing its own fertility. Here is your question. Compost pH testing requires a $15 meter and 2 minutes per batch, and the consequences of applying out-of-range compost include locked-out micronutrients, slow seedling establishment, and season-long underperformance in amended beds. If that's the cost of skipping the test, why is pH the variable almost never mentioned in beginner composting guides, and who benefits from keeping it out of the conversation? Chapter Q: Quick Composting. The 18-day Berkeley method. The transplant window closes in 11 days. The beds aren't ready. You knew they weren't ready going into winter, but the season ran long, and the soil amendments you were counting on are still sitting in a pile that has been slowly, passively decomposing since October. Not finished. Not close to finished. Dark on the outside, but stringy and unbroken in the center, smelling of leaves rather than earth, nowhere near the crumbly uniform texture that would make it safe to put against plant roots. You have 11 days and a pile that needs another 2 months. This is the exact problem the Berkeley method was built to solve. Developed by the University of California at Berkeley and refined through decades of small farm and research application, the 18-day hot composting method is the fastest reliable system for producing finished compost from raw materials without specialized equipment, industrial inputs, or anything beyond what a homesteader already has available. It does not cut corners. It does not produce inferior compost. It produces finished, stable, biologically complete compost in 18 days by doing one thing differently from every standard hot composting method. It controls particle size and turning frequency with a precision that maximizes the biological surface area and oxygen delivery. The thermophilic process needs to run at its absolute peak. Every day of those 18 days is doing specific biological work, and understanding why the schedule is what it is, rather than following it mechanically, is what allows you to adapt it when conditions vary and still get the result. Something I noticed the first time I ran a Berkeley pile: I'd shredded the cardboard more finely than usual, running it through a garden shredder twice before adding it. The pile reached 149 degrees by the end of day 2, rather than day 3, and by day 15, the material looked and smelled finished, rather than finishing. I harvested a test sample, ran the germination test, and found it viable, 3 days ahead of schedule. I filed it away as an anomaly and continued to day 18 for the full batch. I'll come back to what the shredding actually did. The construction requirements for a Berkeley pile are more specific than standard hot composting. Particle size is the first non-negotiable. Materials should be chopped, shredded, or torn to pieces no larger than 1 to 2 inches in any dimension. This is not a preference, it is the mechanical basis for the method's speed. Decomposing organisms work on surface area. A whole cardboard box has a fraction of the surface area of the same cardboard torn into 50 pieces. A whole corn stalk has a fraction of the surface area of the same stalk run through a chipper. Reducing particle size increases the total surface available for microbial colonization by an order of magnitude, and that increase in colonizable surface is what allows a Berkeley pile to generate the biological density necessary for 18-day completion. Materials should be as fresh and varied as possible: grass clippings from a recent mow, kitchen scraps from the current week, freshly shredded cardboard and dry leaves, freshly chipped wood if available. Fresh materials carry higher moisture and more accessible nitrogen than stored or aged materials. The pile is built to the standard 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet minimum, layered at 3:1 browns to greens, with inoculant between layers, and saturated more aggressively than a standard hot pile. The Berkeley method calls for wetting each layer until moisture is at field capacity throughout, which means the freshly built pile should feel heavier and more thoroughly damp than you'd typically build. Days 1 through 4, no turning. Leave the pile completely undisturbed. The initial 4 days allow the mesophilic bacterial population to establish, generate heat, and create the temperature environment that triggers thermophilic bacterial takeover. Turning in the first 4 days disrupts this population establishment before it reaches critical density. The pile should reach 131 degrees or above by day 2 or 3. If it hasn't by day 4, add nitrogen and moisture before proceeding. Day 5, the first turn. This is the critical outside-in inversion. Move the entire outer layer to a new location, rebuild the pile with that outer material at the center, and fork the original center material to the outside. This is not a casual mix. The full inversion is what makes the Berkeley schedule work. Every section of the pile spends time at the hot center, where decomposition is fastest, and nothing stays at the cool periphery long enough to fall behind the rest. Days 6 through 17. Turn every 2 days, maintaining the outside-in inversion each time. Check moisture at each turn. The pile will be losing moisture as it heats. A Berkeley pile runs hotter than a standard hot pile and evaporates water faster. Add water if the squeeze test shows the material releasing less than a drop. The peak temperature window typically runs between days 7 and 9, reaching as high as 155 to 160 degrees at the core, before beginning a gradual decline as the available substrate is consumed and the thermophilic community transitions to the cooler maturation phase. Day 18, harvest and test. Run the germination test before applying to beds. In most cases, an 18-day Berkeley pile managed correctly will pass the germination test, seeds germinating and growing normally in the finished material, and be ready for immediate application. Some batches, depending on material variability and weather conditions, may need an additional 3 to 5 days of passive curing before they fully stabilize. This is not a failure of the method. It is an acknowledgement that biology runs at its own pace within the boundaries you set for it. The high-stakes failure specific to the Berkeley method is skipping turns. Unlike standard hot composting, where a missed turn costs a few days of decomposition speed, a missed Berkeley turn throws off the carefully calibrated schedule that ensures every section of material spends equal time at peak temperature. Skip the day 7 turn, and the outside material, which contains the highest concentration of undecomposed inputs, never reaches the temperatures needed for weed seed and pathogen elimination. The finished product from a poorly turned Berkeley pile carries the same biological risks as unfinished compost from any other method. The accelerated schedule does not compensate for inadequate management. Every turn is load-bearing in this system. The shredded cardboard. The pile that finished 3 days early. What the extra shredding did was reduce particle size below the 1-inch target to something closer to a 1/4 inch across most of the carbon material. That surface area increase gave the thermophilic bacteria a colonizable substrate so much larger than a standard pile that the microbial population reached peak density faster, generated heat faster, and consumed available substrate faster. The method's 18-day timeline assumes particle size around 1 inch. Push it smaller and the timeline compresses. This is the lever most people running Berkeley piles leave completely unexplored. Here is your question. The Berkeley method produces finished compost in 18 days from the same inputs that a standard pile takes 8 to 12 weeks to process. Same biology, same chemistry, same materials, fundamentally different outcome from turning frequency and particle size alone. If the knowledge to accelerate the process this dramatically is this accessible, why do most gardeners accept an 8-week wait as though the timeline is determined by the materials rather than by the management? Chapter R. Raw materials. Sourcing browns and greens, beyond your kitchen. By February, the brown bank is gone. The leaf pile collected in October is finished. The last of the saved cardboard went in 2 weeks ago, and the compost pile is running on kitchen scraps alone, heavy, wet, green dominant, producing the faint ammonia smell of a nitrogen oversaturated system with nothing left to balance it. The pile is failing. The growing season starts in 6 weeks. And the realization setting in, slowly and expensively, is that the $0 system has a gap. A household that composts aggressively through winter runs out of carbon material before spring. You were using raw materials as fast as you collected them and planning nothing for the lean months. This chapter is about building a raw material supply chain that doesn't run dry. Most composting guides treat raw material sourcing as an afterthought. Note that leaves and cardboard are good carbon sources, mention coffee grounds as a nitrogen supplement, and move on. In practice, for anyone composting seriously and continuously, raw material management is as important as pile management. The pile is only as consistent as the inputs feeding it, and a home kitchen-only supply chain is too narrow to sustain a system that's expected to produce finished compost at the rate a productive garden requires. Something I noticed at a small local brewery near my property. During a casual conversation with the owner about what they did with spent grain after each batch, he gestured toward a bin the size of a small car, half full of wet, pale, slightly fermented grain, and said they paid to have it hauled away twice a week, about 1,200 pounds per haul. He offered it to me on the spot. I took a 5-gallon bucket as a test. It sat in my garage overnight, and by morning the bucket was warm to the touch. I filed that away and did nothing about it for 3 months. I'll come back to what I was letting go twice a week. On the green side, the nitrogen sources, the first expansion point beyond kitchen scraps, is coffee grounds. Every coffee shop that runs a commercial espresso machine produces spent grounds continuously, and most are willing to set them aside for collection rather than sending them to the landfill. Starbucks has a formal program for this. Independent shops, when approached directly with a clean bucket and a consistent pickup schedule, will almost universally cooperate. Coffee grounds run approximately 20 to 1 carbon to nitrogen, a strong nitrogen source that heats a pile rapidly and produces no odor when properly balanced with browns. A household that drinks coffee produces a modest continuous supply. A coffee shop produces a supply that can sustain a serious composting operation on its own nitrogen side. Spent brewery grain is the highest impact-free nitrogen source most composters never think to ask for. Fresh spent grain, the barley, wheat, and adjunct malt left after the wort is extracted in the brewing process runs at a carbon-to-nitrogen ratio of roughly 12 to 1, with an NPK profile of approximately 1% nitrogen, 0.5% phosphorus, and additional trace minerals. It is wet, heavy, and heats aggressively when mixed with carbon material, documented at 140 degrees Fahrenheit within 24 hours of mixing with wood chips. Local craft breweries produce it in volumes they need to dispose of regularly, and will typically give it away freely to anyone with a vehicle and a pickup schedule. One brewery batch can provide enough nitrogen input to drive a full Berkeley pile from construction to peak heat. On the brown side, the carbon sources, autumn leaves remain the highest volume free material available, but the collection window is narrow. The habit worth building is not just collecting your own leaves, but actively soliciting neighbors' leaves during the collection week. A note on social media, a door-to-door conversation on the street, a politely worded ask during the 1 week when everyone has bagged carbon sitting at the curb, a single afternoon of collection can build a brown bank large enough to sustain a full year of composting. Tree services are the second major source. Arborists and municipal tree crews produce wood chips in quantities they need to move, and a phone call to a local tree service requesting delivery will frequently result in a free load within a week or two. The ChipDrop platform connects arborists with homeowners specifically for this purpose. Wood chips run at carbon-to-nitrogen ratios between 200 and 400 to 1, a structural carbon source that balances even the most nitrogen-heavy inputs. Cardboard beyond your own household's delivery waste, liquor stores, grocery stores, hardware retailers, and Amazon delivery hubs produce and dispose of corrugated cardboard continuously. Any of these locations, approached with a request for their breakdown cardboard, will typically set it aside rather than bale it for pickup. Plain corrugated cardboard, not waxed, not heavily printed with plastic-based inks, is a clean, reliable, high-carbon material that shreds easily and disappears in an active pile within weeks. The high-stakes failure in raw material management is monoculture sourcing, building a compost system that depends on a single material type for each side of the ratio. A brown bank that is entirely dry leaves runs out in February and leaves the pile nitrogen-saturated and smelling through spring. A nitrogen supply that consists entirely of kitchen scraps is insufficient to sustain a pile through the lean winter months when kitchen output drops and the pile needs more input to maintain biological activity. Diversifying across at least 2 green sources and 2 brown sources creates the redundancy that keeps the system running regardless of which single source becomes temporarily unavailable. The cost of running out of carbon material in February is 6 weeks of a nitrogen-saturated, ammonia-smelling pile that produces nothing usable for the spring planting season. The cost of running out of nitrogen in autumn is a pile that sits cold through the months when outdoor activity is low and the temptation to attend to it is lowest. Either failure takes a system that should be continuously productive and creates a gap that shows up in your soil fertility 6 months later. The brewery near the property, 1,200 pounds of spent grain twice a week, 3 months of nothing done about it. When I finally went back with a clean trash can and a regular pickup schedule, it changed the nitrogen side of my operation more than any other single input had. The pile ran hotter, faster, and more consistently than at any point in the prior 4 years. The input that had been going to a hauling service twice a week, that the brewery was paying to remove became the engine of the highest quality compost I had ever produced, for free, for 2 years, until the brewery closed and I had to find the next source, which is the point. Raw material sourcing is not a one-time problem you solve. It is an ongoing relationship with your local waste stream, active, diversified, and maintained. Here is your question. Every high-impact nitrogen source in this chapter, coffee grounds, brewery grain, neighbor's grass clippings, is being paid to be removed from the businesses and households that produce it. If the inputs that drive a serious composting operation are simultaneously waste streams that people pay to dispose of, what does that say about the way we've organized the relationship between food production and food waste in communities that have the resources to close that loop and consistently choose not to? Chapter S. Soil Application. Getting compost into the garden the right way. 3 inches of finished compost, tilled 8 inches deep, worked into the bed with a rototiller in early April. By the gardening guides, the correct approach, by every measure of application generosity, an above-average amendment. By mid-May, the bed is producing less than the adjacent bed that received a half-inch top dressing and nothing else. The deeply tilled bed has fewer earthworms per square foot, lower moisture retention despite more compost by volume, and a surface that crusts after rain rather than absorbing it. The lightly dressed bed is darker, softer, drains better after heavy rain, and holds moisture longer in dry stretches. The tilled bed looks by late spring like it was disturbed rather than amended. It was, and the disturbance cost more than the compost gave back. Application method determines what finished compost actually delivers to the soil, not the compost itself, not its nutrient content, not its biological quality. You can produce perfect compost and waste most of its benefit by putting it in the wrong place at the wrong time, in the wrong way. This is the final step in the $0 system, and it is treated by most composting guides as obvious. Spread it on and you're done. It is not obvious. It is specific. And the specifics matter in ways that change how your soil behaves across multiple seasons. Something I noticed the first year I ran 2 adjacent beds as a side-by-side comparison, one tilled, one top-dressed, that I didn't have a framework to interpret at the time. The earthworm count per square foot in the tilled bed dropped by roughly half in the weeks following tillage and recovered slowly over the next 2 months. The top-dressed bed maintained a stable population throughout. I noted it in a garden journal I was keeping inconsistently. I'll come back to what that population difference was actually measuring. The case against deep tillage as a primary application method for compost is now well supported by research and practice. Tilling disrupts the soil's fungal network. The hyphal threads that physically bind soil particles extend the effective root zone and form the mycorrhizal partnerships that support plant establishment. A single tillage pass doesn't destroy the soil's biological community, but it fragments and suspends the structural relationships that fungal biology has been building, and those relationships take time to re-establish after disturbance. A bed that is tilled annually never fully develops the fungal architecture that a no-till or minimal-till bed accumulates over years. That architecture is part of what makes old, well-composted gardens feel and behave fundamentally differently from new ones. Tilling also brings buried weed seeds to the surface. A mature bed will have decades of seed bank material at various depths in the soil profile. Tillage moves seeds from below the germination depth, typically the top 2 inches of soil, upward into conditions where light and warmth trigger germination. This is why tilled beds frequently generate a flush of weed emergence in the weeks after turning, regardless of how clean the compost was or how carefully the bed was managed. The weeds were already there. The tillage gave them what they needed. Top dressing. Applying a layer of finished compost directly to the soil surface without incorporation works with these realities rather than against them. Compost applied to the surface is processed downward by rain, irrigation, and biological activity over the growing season. Earthworms draw it into the soil profile naturally, creating the biological incorporation that a tiller forces mechanically. The surface layer acts simultaneously as a moisture-retaining mulch, a weed seed barrier, and a slow-release nutrient source that feeds the soil community from the top down rather than disrupting it from below. Applied in autumn after the growing season, a half-inch to one-inch layer of compost becomes the first food the soil biology encounters in spring, before any cultivation, before any planting, a biological primer that sets the season's soil health in motion. Application depth for top dressing. Half an inch to 1 inch for established beds receiving annual amendments. 2 inches for beds being built for the first time from compacted or depleted soil. 3 inches for beds being converted from lawn or heavily disturbed ground. More than 3 inches in a single application can create a perched water table effect. The compost layer holds moisture so efficiently that the interface between compost and underlying soil stays saturated longer than is beneficial for root development. Multiple lighter applications over consecutive seasons build depth more effectively than a single heavy one. Timing matters as much as depth. Autumn application gives compost the maximum processing time before planting. Rain and temperature fluctuation over winter move the material into the soil profile. Earthworm activity in the mild periods incorporates it biologically. And by spring, the compost is already working as soil rather than sitting on top of it. Spring application, made 3 to 4 weeks before planting rather than at planting time, allows the biological community to stabilize after the compost's introduction before plant roots are competing for the same zone. Applying compost at the moment of transplanting into freshly amended beds, particularly with unfinished compost or compost whose pH hasn't been verified, is the highest risk timing in the application calendar and the source of most compost-related seedling failures. The high-stakes failure in soil application is treating compost as a one-time fix rather than an annual relationship. A bed that receives a heavy compost application in year 1, produces well in year 2, and receives nothing in years 3 and 4 is a bed that is spending its biological bank account without making deposits. The organic matter in finished compost is consumed by the soil community over 1 to 2 growing seasons. What remains after that consumption is the soil's structural legacy: darker color, better aggregate stability, improved drainage and water retention. But the active biological benefit of fresh compost has been metabolized. Sustained soil health requires sustained annual inputs at modest depth rather than intermittent heavy applications spaced years apart. The earthworm count in the tilled bed, the half that disappeared in the weeks following tillage and recovered slowly. What it was measuring was not just earthworm population, it was biological processing capacity. Earthworms are the primary mechanical incorporation agent in a no-till or minimal-till system. They ingest organic matter from the surface, move it through their gut, and deposit nutrient-dense castings at depth. Their population in a given square foot of soil is a direct indicator of how effectively the system is converting surface amendments into root zone fertility. Having the earthworm population through spring tillage halved the soil's biological processing capacity for the 2 months it took the population to recover, and those 2 months are the most critical growth period in the early season calendar. The compost didn't fail. The application method did. Finished compost, applied correctly to a soil biology that's allowed to function, produces the results this entire book has been building toward. Applied incorrectly, it is amendment that never quite lands. Here is your question. Every no-till or minimal-till long-term garden study shows better soil biology, lower weed pressure, and equivalent or higher yields compared to annually tilled systems receiving the same organic inputs. If the evidence is this consistent, and it is, why does rototilling remain the default preparation method in almost every backyard gardening guide published in the last 50 years? Chapter T. Temperature. Reading the pulse of a living pile. It's the second week of May, and the bed is erupting. Not with the transplants you set out 2 weeks ago. Those are alive, barely, yellow-tinged and slow in a way that doesn't respond to water or sun. The eruption is from below. Dozens of thin, thread-like seedlings pushing up through the compost-amended surface, uniform and relentless, covering the bed in a pale green haze that you recognize, by the third week, as grass, Bermuda grass. The seed bank in the compost you applied in April wasn't random contamination. It was a pile that ran at 112 degrees during its active phase, never once reaching the threshold where grass seed loses viability, and you dressed 4 beds with it before the season made the problem visible. You have 4 beds of Bermuda grass. You have a growing season that started 2 weeks late, and you have a compost pile that looked and smelled finished, because finish and safety are not the same thing. When the pile never got hot, temperature is not a vanity metric in hot composting. It is not the thing you monitor, because the guides say to, it is the biological event that determines whether the compost you produce is safe or compromised, whether it can go directly onto plant beds, or whether it is carrying a seed bank, a pathogen load, or a population of organisms that will run their process in your soil at your transplant's expense. Everything this book has built toward the ratio, the layering, the turning, the moisture management, the inoculants, is in service of getting the pile to temperature and holding it there long enough to matter. Something I noticed during a dry autumn when I was monitoring 2 piles simultaneously, one in the open yard, one against the south-facing fence, was that the fence pile peaked at 144 degrees on day 3, while the open pile peaked at 131 on the same day, then dropped more rapidly over the following 48 hours. Same materials, same construction, same turning schedule. The fence pile held its peak temperature a full day longer before dropping. I noted the gap and attributed it to the fence providing some wind protection. I'll come back to what was actually happening. The temperature thresholds that matter in hot composting are specific and non-negotiable. Most weed seeds lose viability when exposed to sustained temperatures of 131 degrees Fahrenheit or above for a minimum of 3 consecutive days. Tougher weed seeds, Bermuda grass, bindweed, certain thistle species, require sustained exposure to 140 degrees or higher for reliable kill. The U.S. Composting Council standard for pathogen reduction in compost, intended for use near food crops, requires the pile to reach 131 to 170 degrees for at least 3 days, with turning between each temperature event to ensure all sections of the pile cycle through the kill zone. A pile that reaches 145 degrees at the center but never gets the outer sections above 120 degrees through the full turning cycle has accomplished partial pathogen reduction. It has protected the material that was in the center during the hot phase, but left the outer sections, which make up the bulk of the pile's volume, undertreated. You push the thermometer into the pile's center on day 2. The needle climbs to 138 degrees and holds. This is the reading you're looking for, the confirmation that thermophilic bacteria have established insufficient density to drive sustained heat. A compost thermometer with a probe long enough to reach the true center of a 3-foot pile, at least 12 to 15 inches of probe length, is the single most useful piece of equipment in the $0 system, and at $20 to $30, it is the only tool purchase the entire method genuinely requires. A kitchen meat thermometer, pushed 2 inches into the pile's surface, tells you nothing useful. The center is where the biology is running, and the center is where the thermometer needs to be. Log the temperature at each turn. Not because record keeping is enjoyable, it rarely is, but because a temperature log reveals the pile's pattern in a way that moment-to-moment observation misses. A pile that peaks on day 3, maintains through day 7, begins declining by day 9, and has fully transitioned to the maturation phase by day 14 is performing on schedule and has almost certainly achieved pathogen and weed seed reduction across its full cycle. A pile that peaks briefly on day 2, drops to 115 by day 5, and never resurfaces above 120 after the first turn is showing you a nitrogen or moisture problem before the problem has time to compromise the finished product. The temperature log is your early warning system. At 160 degrees and above, the pile needs immediate turning, regardless of schedule. The thermophilic bacteria that drive the process begin to experience heat stress above 160 degrees, and a pile left at 165 for more than a day can begin killing its own biological community, paradoxically slowing decomposition at the peak of its heat phase. Turn when the temperature climbs above 160, reintroduce oxygen, and allow the pile to reheat at a sustainable level. This upper threshold is rarely reached in standard backyard hot composting, but is worth knowing because it represents the one scenario where a hotter pile is not a better pile. The high-stakes failure of temperature mismanagement is not a pile that fails to compost, it is a pile that produces compost indistinguishable in appearance and smell from a safely finished product, but carries the biological history of temperatures that never did the necessary work. Weed seed viability in compost is not detectable by eye or nose. Pathogen load in compost is not detectable by color or texture. The only way to know what happened biologically in a pile is to know what temperatures it reached, for how long, and whether the full volume of the pile cycled through that thermal kill zone. A temperature log is that knowledge, made simple, the fence pile and the open pile. The one-day difference in sustained peak temperature. What I eventually understood was that ambient temperature, the temperature of the air surrounding the pile, sets the envelope within which the pile's biology can sustain thermophilic activity. On a cool autumn day, with wind moving across the open yard, the open pile was losing heat to the ambient air fast enough to pull its core temperature down more rapidly after each peak. The fence was simply reducing wind exposure on one side, slowing convective heat loss enough to extend the pile's time in the kill zone by nearly a full day. That fence was doing temperature management work I hadn't planned for and didn't recognize until I thought about it carefully. Sight your pile on the leeward side of a structure, a hedge, or any windbreak, and your peak temperatures will hold longer with no additional intervention. Here is your question. A $25 compost thermometer and a simple log is the difference between knowing your compost is safe to apply to food beds and hoping it is. If the cost of certainty is that small, and the cost of getting it wrong is 4 beds of Bermuda grass in May, why do most composting guides list a thermometer as optional equipment? Chapter U, Using Worm Castings, The Precision Amendment, and How to Apply It, 2 Identical Transplants. Same variety, same seed lot, same germination date, same potting mix, set out on the same day, into the same bed. One goes into a planting hole with a tablespoon of worm castings worked into the base. The other goes in clean, no amendment in the hole, same compost amended bed soil. By day 14, the casting-fed transplant is visibly larger, with deeper leaf color and root development that, when checked at week 4, shows a branching structure the control plant hasn't approached. Not a dramatic difference, not the kind you'd photograph and post with a caption about miracles, but consistent, measurable, repeatable, across 20 trials in 2 seasons, a difference that compounds over the growing season into earlier fruiting, higher yield, and faster recovery from stress. This is not marketing language. It is the result of applying the most bioavailable soil amendment in the $0 system at the precise point in the plant's development where it has the highest impact. Worm castings are not a fertilizer in the conventional sense. They do not deliver a concentrated synthetic nutrient load that the plant absorbs rapidly and exhausts quickly, the way a granular fertilizer does. They deliver available nutrition, primarily nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and a range of trace minerals in a form that is immediately accessible to plant roots, alongside a microbial community that continues working in the soil around the root zone after the application is made. The nutrition is available. The biology is active. The combination is what produces the difference in transplant establishment that the numbers don't fully explain on their own. Something I noticed in my second season of consistent casting application, running comparisons in 3 different beds across different crops, was a pattern in the pepper bed that didn't show up anywhere else. The plants that received castings at transplanting established visibly faster and fruited earlier, as expected. But the plants that received a second casting application as a side dress at the 6-week mark, when the first casting application would have been largely metabolized, produced measurably heavier fruit than those that received only the initial transplant application. The difference wasn't visible at the plant level. It showed up in the harvest basket in August. I filed it away and kept thinking about it through the winter. I'll come back to what the timing told me. The practical application guide for worm castings begins with the highest impact use, direct planting hole application at transplant. 1/2 cup to 1 cup worked into the base of the planting hole and mixed with the surrounding soil before the transplant is set, not placed directly against the root ball, but integrated into the soil in the hole at the level where the transplant's first roots will extend. Allow 1 to 2 days between soil preparation and transplanting when possible to let moisture distribute the castings through the hole before the plant's roots are in contact with them. Fresh castings applied in direct concentration against a very young root system can occasionally show mild growth suppression, the same way any concentrated nutrient source can affect sensitive seedling roots at close contact, but this risk is low with castings relative to synthetic amendments and largely eliminated by the 1 to 2 day settling period. For established plants already in the ground, side dressing is the standard application method. Work 1 to 2 cups of castings into the top 2 to 3 inches of soil around each plant, staying away from the main stem, and water in thoroughly. The castings begin releasing available nutrients with the first watering and continue through subsequent irrigation as the microbial community in the castings processes the organic material they contain into ongoing plant available form. Side dressing is most impactful at the beginning of the fruiting phase, when the plant's nutrient demand is highest and the initial transplant application has been metabolized, and at any point where a plant shows signs of nitrogen stress that a compost top dressing alone hasn't addressed. For seed starting, incorporate castings at 10-20% of total seed starting mix volume, roughly 1 part castings to 4-9 parts base mix. Above 20%, the concentrated nutrient density can suppress germination and early seedling growth rather than support it. The sweet spot is a mix that adds biological activity and moderate available nutrition to the starting medium without creating the concentration gradients that challenge very young root systems. The high-stakes failure in worm castings application is scale mismatch, using them at rates appropriate for a purchased commercial product rather than a home-produced precision amendment. Commercial growers apply worm castings at comparatively low rates because they understand that castings function as a biological catalyst, not a bulk amendment. The per-unit impact is high enough that large volumes are counterproductive and wasteful. Home composters, who apply a thick layer of castings as a general bed amendment, the same way they'd apply finished hot compost, use a high-value material in a low-value application. A tablespoon in the planting hole outperforms a cup spread across the bed surface in both immediate transplant impact and long-term soil biology benefit because the castings are delivered directly to the point where root development is occurring rather than distributed across an area most of it will never reach. Castings are also a finite resource from a home worm bin. A single pound of worms producing at full capacity yields roughly 1 pound of finished castings per week under ideal conditions. That is not a limitless supply. Managing it as a precision input, concentrated at transplant holes and critical growth stage interventions, extends that supply across a full planting season rather than exhausting it in a single bed amendment that delivers a fraction of the impact, the pepper bed, the side dressing at 6 weeks, the heavier fruit in August. What the timing told me was that the worm castings weren't functioning primarily as a nutrient delivery system in that application. By 6 weeks, the plants had sufficient established root zone and compost-fed soil biology to manage their basic nutrient needs. The castings were functioning as a microbial injection at the onset of the fruiting phase, when the plant's biological relationships in the soil, the partnerships with soil fungi, bacteria, and the organisms processing the nutrients the plant was drawing on, were most under demand. The castings introduced fresh, active biology at the moment the existing soil biology was working hardest. The heavier fruit wasn't from the nutrients in the castings directly. It was from what those organisms supported in the soil around the roots over the following 6 weeks. That's the precision this amendment offers when you understand what it is and apply it accordingly, not a fertilizer with a delayed release mechanism, but a biological intervention that changes what the soil is capable of doing for the plant at the moment it needs the most support. Here is your question. Worm castings applied at a tablespoon per transplant hole deliver measurably better establishment outcomes than a cup spread across a bed surface. The precision approach outperforms the bulk approach while using a fraction of the material. If that's the pattern, what does it suggest about how we measure the value of soil amendments generally and whether the industry benefits more from selling us volume than from teaching us precision? Chapter 5. Vermiculture. Building and running your worm bin. The bin arrived in a flat pack box on a Tuesday. By the following Tuesday, it was fully assembled, loaded with moistened coconut coir bedding, and populated with a pound of red wigglers from an online supplier. By the Tuesday after that, the worms were dead. Not most of them, all of them. The bedding was wet and airless, and smelled of rot. The instruction guide that came with the bin had 11 steps and not a single mention of what the bedding should smell like, what the moisture should feel like, or what the first signs of trouble look like before the bin tips past recovery. The guide said, add food twice a week. It didn't say what happens when you do that before the population is established enough to process it. The bin was not defective. The guidance was, this chapter is the practical counterpart to Chapter E, which introduced you to the red wiggler as a species. This is about the system, the bin itself, the bedding, the feeding schedule, the harvesting method, and the management habits that keep a worm bin running productively for years, rather than cycling through the failure and restart loop that discourages most new vermicomposters before the bin has produced a single useful harvest. Something I noticed the first winter I ran a worm bin in an unheated garage, the kind of decision that all the guides caution against, since red wigglers are supposed to need temperatures above 40 degrees to remain active, was that the bin slowed dramatically but never fully crashed during 3 weeks when overnight temperatures dropped to 28 degrees. The worms clustered in the center of the bin, around the fresh food additions, and the outer inch of bedding froze solid. The center did not. When temperatures rose back above 40 degrees, activity resumed within 48 hours. I'd expected to find a dead bin and found instead a dormant one. I filed it away as luck and moved on. I'll come back to what was actually protecting them. The bin itself does not need to be purchased. A plastic storage tote, the opaque latching kind available from any home goods store, drilled with a quarter-inch bit across the bottom for drainage and across the upper sides for ventilation, is a fully functional worm bin that outperforms most purpose-built commercial products in airflow and accessibility. Size matters. A bin that's too small limits population growth and creates moisture management problems because small volumes are more susceptible to rapid pH and moisture swings than larger volumes. A standard 18-gallon tote is a workable starting size for a household of 2 to 4 people. A 27-gallon tote is preferable for larger households or anyone planning to produce meaningful casting volumes. Bedding preparation is the step most instruction guides under-explain and the step that determines whether the bin's first month goes well or poorly. Bedding serves two functions. It is the worm's habitat and their primary carbon source. It needs to hold moisture like a wrung-out sponge, 40 to 60% moisture content, and it needs to be light and airy enough that the worms can move freely through it. Shredded cardboard and paper is the most accessible bedding material. Aged coconut core, rehydrated and squeezed to the correct moisture level, is an excellent commercial option. Shredded dry leaves work well if the particle size is small. Whole leaves mat together and reduce airflow. Aged horse manure, mentioned in vermicomposting literature as an inoculant-rich bedding medium, is worth using if you have access to it. It introduces microbial diversity that accelerates the bin's establishment phase significantly. Fill the bin 2/3 deep with prepared bedding before adding worms. Let the prepared bedding settle for 24 to 48 hours before the worms go in. This allows any pH or temperature extremes from the preparation process to stabilize before the population is introduced. Add the worms to the surface of the bedding and leave the bin lid off or slightly open in a lit space for the first hour. Worms avoid light. They will burrow into the bedding immediately. This behavior also tells you that the bedding conditions are acceptable. Worms that stay at the surface after introduction are sensing something wrong with the bedding, temperature, pH, or moisture outside their tolerance range. Feeding in the first month should be conservative. Bury a small amount of kitchen scraps, roughly half a cup per square foot of bin surface area, in a different location each time, under an inch of bedding. The burial prevents fruit fly attraction and ensures the scraps are in contact with the bedding microbial community rather than composting aerobically on the surface. Do not add more until the previous feeding is visibly reduced. In the first weeks, this may mean feeding once every 4 to 7 days. As the population grows and processing capacity increases, feeding frequency can rise to every 2 to 3 days, then daily, if the population is large enough to support it. The high-stakes failure is every instruction guide's consistent blind spot. Overfeeding in the establishment phase is the primary cause of new bin failure, and it is invisible until the bin has already tipped past recovery. Food decomposes in the bin whether or not worms are processing it. Unprocessed food creates heat, lowers pH through organic acid production, increases moisture, and drives the bin toward the anaerobic conditions that force worms to the walls and eventually out. A bin that smells sour, feels wetter than it did on the previous check, and shows worms clustering at the top has been overfed, not necessarily this week, but in the accumulating pattern of the past 2 to 3 weeks. The intervention is immediate. Stop feeding, add dry shredded cardboard to absorb excess moisture and raise pH. Turn the bedding gently to reintroduce oxygen and leave the bin alone for 5 to 7 days before resuming at a reduced rate. Harvesting castings from a mature bin, a bin that has been running for 3 to 4 months and whose lower layers are predominantly dark, uniform casting material with minimal identifiable bedding, is a simple process that most people overcomplicate. 2 weeks before intended harvest, stop adding food to one side of the bin and bury all new food additions in the opposite side only. The worm population will migrate toward the food, concentrating in the active side. After 2 weeks, scoop the relatively worm-free casting material from the inactive side into a bucket. Sift through it by hand to return any remaining worms and cocoons to the bin. Add fresh bedding to the harvested side and resume normal feeding. This harvest method takes 20 minutes and produces finished castings without exposing the worm population to the stress of a full bin dump. The garage bin in winter, the frozen outer inch. The worms clustered alive in the center around the food. What was protecting them was the food itself, specifically, the biological activity of fresh kitchen scraps decomposing in the bin center was generating enough heat to keep the core temperature marginally above the lethal threshold, the same way the center of a compost pile stays warmer than its outer layers. The bin's thermal mass was too small to protect the outer bedding from freezing, but the food decomposition heat in the core was just sufficient to maintain a survivable zone. They weren't lucky. They were in the warmest spot the bin could offer, doing exactly what their biology directs them toward, following the food, following the warmth, staying alive in a system that was almost but not quite past what they could tolerate. That is Eisenia fetida. Not fragile, not demanding. Specific, in the way that everything alive is specific and more resilient than the instruction guides give them credit for when the fundamentals are right. Here is your question. A correctly set up and managed worm bin produces the highest quality soil amendment in the $0 system at zero recurring cost from material that would otherwise leave your property as waste. If that's true, and it is, why does vermiculture remain a niche practice while synthetic fertilizer is the default soil amendment in the majority of backyard gardens? Is it the learning curve, the failure rate of poorly documented first attempts, or something about the way we've been sold the idea that soil fertility comes from a bag rather than a bin? Chapter W: Weed Seeds and Pathogens, What Heat Destroys and What It Doesn't. The bed was clean in April. You'd amended it carefully, applied finished compost from a pile that had been running since September, and set out your transplants on a cool morning in good confidence. By the end of May, you're pulling weeds every 3 days. Not the usual flush of opportunistic annuals from disturbed soil, something specific and systematic, a ground-level carpet of identical thin-leafed seedlings pushing up through the entire amended area, denser near the center where the compost application was deepest. By June, you identify them. Black nightshade, Solanum nigrum, a species whose seeds can survive 108 degrees Fahrenheit for over 14 days before losing viability. Your pile peaked at 114. Everything in this book about temperature has been building toward this chapter because temperature management in hot composting is not primarily about decomposition speed, it is about biological safety. A pile that decomposes completely but never reaches the thermal threshold for weed seed and pathogen kill produces finished compost in the visual and textural sense and delivers a seed bank directly to your beds. The difference between a pile that finishes and a pile that finishes safely is not visible in the product. It is recorded only in the temperature log, if you kept one, or discovered in the bed in May, if you didn't. Something I noticed in a pile I built in late summer with an unusually high proportion of tomato plant debris, spent vines, removed suckers, a few plants pulled because of early blight symptoms, was that the pile reached temperature normally and ran a complete hot cycle. When I applied the finished compost the following spring, I found tomato seedlings germinating in two of the four amended beds. Not many, six or eight. I pulled them, assumed they were from seed in the soil, and moved on. They appeared again the following year in the same beds, from the same compost batch. I'll come back to what that pattern told me. The thermal biology of weed seed and pathogen destruction is species-specific in ways that make blanket temperature targets insufficient for full protection. As a general rule, a pile sustained at 131 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit for a minimum of 3 consecutive days kills the majority of common weed seeds. But the majority is not all. Black nightshade requires sustained exposure to 140 degrees for nearly 3 hours for 90% mortality and 158 degrees for 10 minutes for reliable kill. Purslane requires 56 hours at 122 degrees for 90% mortality. Johnson grass seed, one of the most problematic in warm climate gardens, requires sustained high temperature exposure that a pile peaking at 131 and cycling down between turns may not deliver reliably to every section of material. The U.S. Composting Council standard for pathogen reduction, the process to further reduce pathogens protocol, requires pile temperatures of 131 to 170 degrees Fahrenheit sustained for at least 3 consecutive days, with turning between temperature events to ensure the full pile volume cycles through the kill zone. This is the standard that makes compost safe for application near edible crops. Meeting it requires not just reaching temperature at the core, but documenting that every section of the pile, including the outer layers, cycled through the thermophilic zone during the turning sequence. A pile that reaches 145 at the center, but whose outer layers never exceed 115, has treated perhaps 40% of its volume to the pathogen reduction standard. The other 60% is applied to your beds as untreated material. This is why turning frequency and the outside-in inversion method from the chapter on turning matter beyond decomposition speed, each turn cycles the undertreated outer material into the hot center. Each reheating after a turn exposes that material to the kill zone for the first time. A pile that is turned correctly 3 times over the active thermophilic phase has cycled its full volume through temperatures that reduce pathogen and weed seed loads to safe levels. A pile that is never turned, or turned insufficiently, has not. Common pathogens that hot composting reliably eliminates when temperature protocols are met. E. coli. O157, H7 is inactivated in minutes at 131 degrees Fahrenheit. Salmonella species require similar conditions. Most human pathogenic bacteria, fungi, and viruses are eliminated by sustained thermophilic temperatures when they are in the pile's active zone during the heat cycle. The caveat is always the same. The material has to be in the kill zone, not at the cool periphery, and the temperature has to hold for the required duration rather than spiking briefly and dropping. The high-stakes failure in this chapter is specific and serious. Applying compost from a pile that included diseased plant material without confirming adequate temperature management introduces the pathogens you were trying to eliminate directly to the beds where you're growing food. Early blight spores on tomato debris survive composting at temperatures below 131 degrees. Late blight can survive under similar conditions. Clubroot of brassicas, a soil-borne pathogen that can persist in soil for decades, requires sustained temperatures above 140 degrees for reliable kill in compost. A pile that ran at 115 degrees and smells like finished compost is not safe to apply to beds where brassicas were previously affected by clubroot, regardless of how complete its decomposition appears. The tomato seedlings in the amended beds, the pile built with blighted vines, the seedlings appearing for two consecutive seasons. What the pattern told me was that the early blight debris had not been the problem. The tomato seeds in the spent fruit material I'd composted alongside the vines had survived the pile's temperature cycle, and those seeds were viable enough to germinate when placed in a warm spring bed. The pile had reached temperature, but the temperature event had lasted only a day and a half before the first turn dropped it, and the seed material, dense, internally insulated, had not experienced the sustained thermal exposure needed for kill. The reheating after the turn had reached the same core temperature, but the seed-dense material was then in the outer section. From that season forward, no spent tomato fruit in the pile unless the batch will run multiple full heat cycles at 140 degrees or above. For anything I'm uncertain about, the germination test before application, not as an afterthought, as the standard. Here is your question. Weed seeds and pathogens in compost are invisible, odorless, and undetectable without a temperature record or a germination test, and the consequences of missing them range from a weedy spring to introducing persistent soil pathogens to beds you'll be growing food in for years. If the stakes are that high and the monitoring tools cost $25 and 15 minutes, why do most home composting guides treat temperature management as aspirational rather than as the non-negotiable safety standard it actually is? Chapter 10, Xenobiotics, What Never Goes in the Pile, and Why the Tomatoes Curl. Not the upper leaves, the whole plant, from the base up, every new shoot expressing the same tight downward curl that gets worse with each week of growth. The plants are alive. They set fruit, but the fruit is small and misshapen, the plants stunted at half the height they should be. You amend the beds, check the pH, rule out mosaic virus, rule out calcium deficiency. The damage is consistent across four beds and three tomato varieties. It started the year you began sourcing grass clippings from a neighbor whose lawn receives professional treatment twice a season. The clippings looked clean. They smelled like fresh grass. They ran a good heat cycle in the pile. The compost they produced looked and tested finished. It was finished. It was also contaminated with aminoperalid, a broadleaf herbicide in the pyridine carboxylic acid family, applied to your neighbor's lawn, present in the clippings at concentrations too low to detect visually, and stable enough to survive composting, soil incorporation, and an entire growing season while delivering enough active chemistry to distort auxin signaling in every broadleaf plant in the amended beds. Aminoperalid does not break down in hot composting. This is the critical distinction between it and most organic contaminants, which the biological heat of a well-managed pile processes along with everything else. Research from Oregon State University and other institutions has documented that aminoperalid concentrations remain nearly constant through composting, with meaningful degradation requiring sustained aerobic soil conditions over 150 to 300 days. The composting process alone does not eliminate it. A pile built with aminoperalid contaminated inputs produces aminoperalid contaminated compost. No ratio management, no temperature cycle, no turning schedule changes that outcome. Something I noticed at a garden exchange 2 years before I understood what aminoperalid was. A woman described her tomato symptoms, the curled leaves, the stunted growth, the consistent damage across multiple varieties, and the conversation moved in circles through nutrient deficiency diagnoses and pest hypotheses without landing anywhere. She mentioned her compost pile, mentioned that she'd started adding free hay from a local horse farm the previous year. Nobody at the exchange made the connection. I didn't either. I filed the symptom description away because it was strange and vivid. I'll come back to it. Xenobiotics, compounds foreign to biological systems that resist natural decomposition, are the category of compost contaminant that the $0 framework requires the most caution around, because the zero-cost sourcing of raw materials that makes this system economically viable also creates the most exposure to contaminated inputs. Free hay, free straw, free manure, free grass clippings from treated lawns, all of these are high-value composting inputs that can carry persistent herbicide residues at concentrations too low to detect by any method short of laboratory testing, and high enough to damage sensitive crops for multiple growing seasons after application. The four persistent herbicides of greatest concern in home composting are aminopyrrolid, clopyrrolid, picloram, and aminocyclopyrachlor. All are synthetic auxin herbicides used primarily for broadleaf weed control in pastures, hayfields, roadsides, and residential lawns. All are characterized by low application rates, measured in ounces per acre, that leave residues in treated plant material at concentrations sufficient to affect sensitive crops. All pass through animal digestive systems largely intact, meaning manure from animals that graze treated hay or pasture can carry active herbicide residues into a compost pile without any indication in the manure's appearance or smell. The bioassay test, the only practical field test available to home composters for persistent herbicide contamination, involves growing sensitive indicator plants in a 50-50 mix of the suspect compost and clean potting mix and comparing their development against a control group growing in clean potting mix alone. Tomatoes and beans are the most sensitive indicator species. Aminopyrrolid exposure produces the characteristic leaf curl at very low concentrations. If the test plants show curling, distortion, or stunted growth relative to the control after 2 weeks, the compost is contaminated and should not be applied to vegetable beds. It can be spread on lawn areas or non-edible plantings where broadleaf crop damage is not a concern, and continued aerobic decomposition in open soil will eventually break the herbicide down, but the timeline is measured in months to years, not weeks. The practical guidance for $0 composters sourcing materials beyond their own household: ask directly and specifically whether any material you're receiving, hay, straw, grass clippings, horse or cattle manure, comes from areas treated with broadleaf herbicides in the past 2 years. Most sources will answer honestly. Lawn care professionals can tell you what products they apply. Horse farms that source commercial hay should be able to tell you whether the hay supplier uses aminopyrrolid products. Any material whose treatment history cannot be verified should be run through the bioassay before being applied to food growing beds. The broader xenobiotic category extends beyond herbicides. Treated wood products, pressure-treated lumber, painted wood, manufactured wood products containing formaldehyde-based adhesives should never go into a compost pile. The preservatives and adhesives they contain include copper compounds, chromium, and arsenic in older formulations, and their breakdown products accumulate in finished compost and eventually in soil. Glossy printed paper and heavily inked cardboard introduces heavy metal-based pigments that have no place in food-growing soil. Plastic-coated materials, synthetic fabrics, rubber products, and any material that does not have a clear biological origin should be excluded. The woman at the garden exchange, the curled tomatoes, the stunted growth, the free hay from the horse farm. What she was describing was a aminopyrrolid injury that had likely been building in her soil for 2 seasons before it became dramatic enough to diagnose. The hay she'd added to her pile was probably not treated directly. It was more likely that the hay supplier's fields had been sprayed the previous season, and the herbicide residues had persisted in the dry plant material through harvest, baling, storage, and the composting process, arriving in her beds fully intact and biologically active. She had done nothing wrong. She had sourced free material in good faith from a trusted local supplier. The inputs were contaminated before they ever reached her property. There is no foolproof protection against this risk in a zero-cost sourcing model. The bioassay test is the closest thing available, and it costs the price of a packet of tomato seeds and 2 weeks of attention. That's the investment that stands between your beds and a growing season written off to damage you can't undo once it's in the soil. Here is your question. The inputs most likely to carry persistent herbicide contamination, commercial hay, treated lawn clippings, feedlot manure, are also the free, high-volume raw materials that make serious composting economically viable for most homesteaders. If sourcing freely means accepting a contamination risk that laboratory testing costs hundreds of dollars to confirm, are we asking small growers to choose between economic viability and food safety? And if that's the choice the current regulatory gap creates, What does it say about who bears the cost of an industry's failure to label its products with the downstream consequences they produce? Chapter Y, Yield, Measuring Your Soil's Transformation Season by Season, 3 years of composting, 3 years of turning piles, managing moisture, sourcing materials, applying finished compost to beds, and you have no idea whether it's working. The garden produces, it has always produced, and while it feels like things are improving, you have nothing to compare against except memory, which is unreliable, optimistic, and specific to the years when everything went right, rather than the average. You added compost. The beds are darker than they were. The tomatoes were better this year, or maybe that was the variety, or the weather. You don't know. You've been running a system for 3 years, and you've never measured it. This chapter is about building the measurement practice that makes 3 years of work legible, that turns intuition into evidence and effort into a record you can read, learn from, and improve against. Something a market gardener told me at a farm tour I attended years ago, when I asked how she assessed whether her soil amendments were working, she picked up a handful of soil from the bed we were standing in, squeezed it, and crumbled it back. Then she said the number of earthworms she found per square foot of bed when she first started amending was 3. This season, the same test in the same beds produced 22. She'd been recording it annually for 6 years. She said it told her more about whether the soil was improving than any nutrient panel or yield record she kept. I filed that number, 22 per square foot, away for the rest of the tour and most of the drive home. I'll come back to what it actually measures. The earthworm count is the most accessible, lowest cost, and arguably most informative single indicator of soil biological health available to a home composter. The test requires a hand trowel, a 12-inch square marked out in the bed, and the ability to count to 20. Dig 12 inches deep in the marked square, turn the soil out onto a surface, hand sort it, and count every earthworm present. A healthy, biologically active soil, supporting sustained composting, should show 10 or more earthworms per square foot in the active growing season. Fewer than 5 suggests the soil biology is still developing or that something is suppressing the population. Run this test in the same bed, in the same location within that bed, at the same time of year, late spring, when soil temperature is moderate and moisture is adequate, and record the number annually. The trend line over 4 to 6 years of composting will show you more about what your amendments are building than any other single measurement you can take. The earthworm population is not the measurement of interest in itself. It is a proxy for the soil biological community that worms both participate in and depend on. Earthworms require organic matter to feed on, aerobic conditions to survive in, stable pH, adequate moisture, and the absence of synthetic biocides. A rising earthworm population means the soil is providing all of those conditions consistently, which means the compost amendments are building organic matter, maintaining biology-friendly pH, and improving the moisture-holding capacity that keeps the population viable through dry periods. Conversely, a flat or declining earthworm count in a bed that's receiving annual compost applications is a diagnostic signal. Something is interfering with the biological community the amendments should be building. That investigation into pH, compaction, drainage, possible contamination is more useful than any amount of additional amendment without diagnosis. Secondary measurements worth building into a seasonal practice, pH testing, once annually in spring before planting, using a basic soil pH meter. A bed that begins at pH 5, 8, and moves toward 6, 5 over 3 years of compost application is performing correctly. The organic matter's buffering capacity is driving pH toward the range where nutrient availability is highest for most food crops. A bed that stays flat at pH 5, 5, despite annual compost applications, may have an underlying drainage issue, an acid parent material that requires lime addition, or a moisture regime that's maintaining acidic conditions the compost can't override. The pH record tells you which beds are responding and which ones need additional diagnosis. The compressibility test, pressing 2 fingers 2 inches into bed soil and feeling the resistance, is informal but genuinely informative when run annually in the same location. Soil that compresses and deforms easily, releases when pressure is removed, and doesn't leave a lasting depression is structurally healthy. Soil that feels hard, doesn't deform under finger pressure, or leaves a visible indentation is compacted, which indicates either that the soil biology is not building structure at the rate the compost inputs should be driving, or that foot traffic, tillage, or equipment is undoing what the biology builds. The compressibility test is not a measurement you record numerically. It is a calibration that lives in your hands, trained by annual comparison against the same locations in the same beds. The high-stakes failure in yield measurement is the absence of any baseline. 3 years of composting with no records is 3 years of building something you can't evaluate, adjust, or defend against the counter-argument that the improvement was from weather, or the variety, or the phase of the moon. A baseline established in year one, earthworm count, soil pH, a basic crop yield record by bed, transforms subsequent seasons from anecdote into evidence. You don't need laboratory soil analysis. You need consistent, simple measurements taken at consistent times, recorded somewhere you can find them, and compared year over year. The market gardener's 22 earthworms per square foot. What it actually measured, beyond the population itself, was the accumulated biological work of 6 years of organic matter cycling, 6 years of compost feeding the soil community building the structure holding moisture, the moisture supporting the earthworm population processing the organic matter into deeper soil profile fertility. 22 earthworms per square foot is not a standalone fact. It is a record of compounding. Every year of correct management made the next year's results slightly more possible. The starting point was 3 earthworms per square foot, in beds that had been conventionally managed for years before she started composting. The trajectory, 3 to 22 over 6 years, is what this entire book has been building toward. That trajectory is available to every person running the $0 system correctly. It does not require extraordinary inputs, perfect management, or laboratory-grade analysis. It requires consistency, observation, and the willingness to record what you find instead of trusting memory to hold what the soil is telling you. Here is your question. The most important measurement in a composting system, the one that tells you whether everything you're doing is actually building soil biology, is an earthworm count that takes 10 minutes and costs nothing. If that measurement is this simple and this informative, why do you think most gardeners have never done it? And what would change about how you garden if you did it every year for the next 6? Chapter Z. Zero waste loop. Closing the cycle and running the full system. There is a garden in this story that has been running a closed organic loop for 23 years. It belongs to a woman I know through a regional seed exchange, someone I would describe as unremarkable in her methods, not particularly scientific, not evangelically committed to any system or philosophy, just consistent. She composts. She feeds the pile what the kitchen and yard produce. She applies what the pile gives back. She has been doing this in the same quarter acre since the year her youngest child started school. The soil in her beds is almost black, not amended black, the dark color of fresh compost laid on top, structurally black, the color running 6-8 inches deep, crumbling in the hand with the loose, almost living weight of material that has been cycling organic matter so long it has accumulated biological memory, the way old wood accumulates rings. Her earthworm count, when I ran the test in one of her main production beds with her permission, was 31 per square foot. The soil held moisture through a dry July without irrigation, while my beds, 3 miles away and 3 years into a serious composting practice, needed water every 3 days. The same rain, the same season. Different soil, because one of us had been doing this for 23 years and one had been doing it for 3. That gap is not discouraging. It is the most motivating fact in this entire book, because it is a compounding record. Not a gap that exists because she had resources or expertise or access I don't have, but because she started earlier and stayed consistent. The soil she has now is the soil I am currently building. Every season of correct management is a deposit into an account that pays compound interest in the form of biology, structure, moisture retention, and yield. The zero waste loop is not a technique. It is a direction of travel. You either move toward it or away from it. There is no static position. Something she mentioned while we stood in the bed looking at the soil, almost in passing, that I've thought about many times since. She said that in the first 3 years, the results were invisible. The soil looked the same. The yields weren't dramatically better. She kept composting, not because she could see it working, but because she understood that the organisms she was feeding were smaller than she could see, and that biological systems don't announce themselves on a quarterly basis the way a financial account does. She kept making deposits because she believed the account existed. I'll come back to what she said at the end of that conversation. The zero waste loop in its complete form runs like this. The household produces kitchen waste, vegetable scraps, coffee grounds, eggshells, fruit waste, continuously, daily in small quantities. That waste goes into either the worm bin or a collection point feeding the hot pile, depending on its content. The yard and garden produce browns, dry leaves in autumn, wood chip accumulation, spent plant matter through the growing season that feed the pile's carbon side and are stored against winter and early spring when green material is scarce. The hot pile runs at 3-to-1 browns to greens, moisture managed, turned on schedule, temperature monitored through the thermophilic phase. The worm bin runs in parallel, processing the softer kitchen waste the hot pile doesn't need, producing castings applied as a precision amendment at transplant and critical growth stages. Finished compost from the hot pile is applied to beds as an annual top dressing, building organic matter, supporting soil biology, improving structure each season. Earthworm counts rise, pH stabilizes, moisture retention improves. The yield trajectory moves upward, slowly, more in year 4 than year 2, more in year 6 than year 4. Nothing leaves the property that should stay. Nothing is purchased that the system produces. That is what $0 means in full. Not that setup costs nothing. Wire, a thermometer, a tote for the worm bin represent a modest one-time investment. But the ongoing fertility inputs, the nitrogen, the carbon, the microbial inoculants, the soil amendments are all generated within the property's own organic waste stream. The waste leaves no longer have a destination at the curb. The cardboard boxes don't go to the recycling center. The kitchen scraps don't fill a landfill. They cycle. They become the soil that grows the food that produces the scraps that go back to the pile. The closed loop is not an abstract ideal. It is the biological reality of every functioning ecosystem on Earth, the one humans opted out of when we created a food system that imports fertility and exports waste. The $0 composting system is, in its most honest framing, a decision to opt back in, on a small scale, on one property, for one household. Without waiting for the food system to change, or the policies to shift, or the industry to reform, the loop closes when you decide to close it, and it begins compounding the day you do. The high-stakes failure at this final stage, the failure that negates everything the previous 25 chapters built, is intermittency. The loop doesn't close if the pile gets managed for 2 seasons and abandoned in the 3rd. The biology doesn't compound if the worm bin gets neglected into failure every other winter. The soil doesn't transform on the schedule of enthusiastic years alternating with neglected ones. The system rewards consistency more than intensity. A pile that is managed adequately every week produces more over 5 years than a pile that is managed perfectly for 3 months and ignored for 9. The investment is low per session. The return is in the pattern, not the peaks. What she said at the end of the conversation in the garden, as we walked back toward the gate, I asked her what she would tell someone just starting out, someone in their first season, standing in front of a new pile wondering if it would ever produce anything worth using. She thought about it for a moment. Then she said, just keep feeding it. Even when you can't see anything happening, especially then, the part that matters is too small to see, and it's always working. You have now walked through every letter of this system. You know what activates a pile and what starves it. You know what your kitchen scraps are worth and what your cardboard boxes are carrying. You know how to read a pile's smell, its temperature, its biology. You know what heat destroys and what it can't touch. You know what never goes in and why. You know how to measure what you're building and how to close the loop so nothing leaves that should stay. The pile is waiting. The worm bin is ready to start. The soil under your beds is ready to become something different than it is today, one season at a time, through a system that costs nothing to run and pays compound interest in biology that outlasts the gardener who builds it. Here is your final question, the one this entire book has been circling. You now have everything you need to close the loop on your own property, produce premium organic soil from your household waste at zero recurring cost, and build soil biology that compounds in your favor for decades. The knowledge is complete. The method is proven. The inputs are free. What's the reason you haven't already started, and is that reason still good enough?